sorry. The subtle nod got me. Hello and welcome to the 10th session of Season 7 of like a decade into this project of the Silmarillion Film Project. And tonight, everybody's here, which is excellent because we're going to plan death and destruction.
That's it. It is time to make sure that there is a sufficient quantity of tears involved in the Nirnaeth Arnoidead.
We've been holding back on some death and destruction, for yeah. sure.
That's not it. Nearly enough misery.
No more.
That's it.
You could unfortunately count the tears up until this point.
Exactly. That was my fear. is that they were large numbers, but still countable. So yeah, that's the problem. But yes, unfettered misery. That is what we are setting out to achieve here this evening. So yeah, it's going to be great. So our challenge here today, which is going to be a lot of fun, is that, of course, as we've been describing, you know, we have the whole sales pitch on the battle, right? There's Mythos's plan for the battle, which needs to be a really good plan. So we need to devise in full, not just in the kind of sketchy, you start over here and we'll start over there kind of plan that, we get in the book, but more detailed of how exactly they mean to take down Thangorodrim, how they're going to, well, not the whole mountain range, but like, anyway, they're going to get it. They need to have a plan that's workable, that actually really seems to have a chance for success. Because again, in order to maximize everyone's suffering, the suffering, the audience, as well as the characters, we need to make it possible for people really to invest in the idea that this plan is going to succeed or has a good chance of succeeding, and they can win. And then, of course, we have to have what really happens. So we need to plan both of those threads here this evening. Both the plan that doesn't happen and the horrible truth that actually does occur. So that's going to be a great deal of fun. Before we begin, even more fun than unfettered misery is our announcements here. So we have lots of things going on. We're coming into the heart of moot season in this coming month. Tex Moot on April 6th, then UK Moot over in York, England on the 27th of April. And then SoCal in May 4th, and then Edmonton for Wild Rose Moot on May 18th, and then Mythmoot 11 in June. So it's going to be a really fun, that's going to be a really fun stretch. And we have some things for the fall taking shape already. New England Moot on the 19th of October, Carolina Moot on the 9th of November. Lots of things. And we've got our, as we announced a little while back, though I think registration isn't open yet, which is why it's not on this list here yet. But we have Ranger Moot coming up in September, which is going to be great fun. That's the one that we're holding at a Boy Scout camp in Cincinnati. And we're going to be holding a moot at a Boy Scout camp, which has on premises both a wooden palisade and a castle. And we're going to do lots of reenactments over the course. Like, reenactments are going to be like the theme of the whole weekend. It's going to be great. I don't even know which things we're going to reenact. We're going to do a lot of reenactments over the course of that weekend. It's going to be really fun. Anyway, so that's going to be actually the weekend of Bilbo's birthday in September. We may reenact the party tree on Sunday the 23rd, so we'll see how that goes, but that's going to be in Cincinnati, Ohio on the weekend of the 22nd 23rd of September this year. And we're going to Germany for the first time. Stuttmoot is going to be happening that was a little negotiation, so it's going to be in Stuttgart. Our host in Stuttgart said, like, can we call it Stuttmoot? And I was like, we can if we spell it with a U with an umlaut. I insist. That's right. So we negotiated that. It was good. Anyway, Stuttmoot is going to be great. It's going to be, like, actually, like, in the middle of, like, their local, like, Oktoberfest celebration and stuff. So it's going to be, there's going to be moot. There's going to be beer and pretzels. It's going to be great. So we're going to have a great time in Germany. This is Yeah, yeah, yes. And David Michael, I was indeed thinking about the Haladin at the stockade. Was one of the things that immediately came to my mind. So yeah, there's going to be lots of possibilities there. The other sort of announcement thing that I've been talking about this week, we don't have to talk about this a whole lot, but I've been really excited this week by the public announcement of, to me, one of the most exciting things to come in the Tolkien world in a long time, and that is the announcement of the publication of the poetic works of J.R.R. Tolkien this fall, edited by Hammond and Scull. I've been waiting for the poetic works to be edited and published at some point. And Hammond and Scull have come through. The projection for the book is that it's going to be like 1,500 pages. It's like 1,500 pages long. It's like a three-volume set of the poetic works. It's going to contain at least... Well, okay. They say 60 unpublished poems. But I suspect there are ones among the published poems which are like technically published poems, but not published anywhere that any of us could ever. I mean, like, I know Hammond and Scull well enough to suspect that if, you know, because there are a whole bunch of poems that Tolkien published in like the local parish journal and whatever. It was a whole bunch of like, and I doubt that Hammond and Scull would call those unpublished because they were technically published before. Just they've not been accessible, and like no one alive has ever read them, essentially, or almost no one. So anyway, I'm excited to see them all. So it's going to be very, very exciting. I'm probably going to be in some mechanism or other, spending the majority of my declining years talking about this volume. So it's going to be, so anyway, just, so for people who haven't heard that news, I wanted to share it and just kind of talk about it. I don't know how or when or where exactly I'm going to end up discussing all these poems, but I think it's going to be pretty cool. Okay. Anyway, so that is stuff that's happening right now. Now let's get back to the battle. So, remembering first kind of where the Nirnaeth or Noediad is sitting. So it's basically the last three episodes, except we're going to have episode 10, right? Also involved in the like pregame, right? That's where we're doing the Glaurung stuff.
Right. So we've made the decision that this is not a battle, but a series of events.
Right.
Which it seems appropriate.
War. Yeah,
which Tolkien does, in fact, at one point describe it as a war.
Mm-hmm.
He actually uses the word war a few times. He says, on the fourth day of the war.
Yes. Well, and even when you look at the way that he describes it in terms of the map, I mean, you've got different movements taking place way apart. It's not like a single battle, like one day battle event by any means. No. So.
Exactly. And he did have the Dorthonian campaign happen separately from the main part of the Nirnaeth. So we have kind of considered that like the opening campaign. So it will roll right into the Nirnaeth from what happens in Dorthonian. So therefore, yes, it's actually going to be the final four episodes of the season will all be this war.
Yes, exactly. And there will be a couple other things like that. I'm seeing the you know, the partings and stuff, so, you know, there'll be other things happening, but essentially, so we're looking at, kind of diving a little more deeply here into how we're going to stage things, for these last four episodes. Okay. So overall plan for the battle, right? Mm-hmm. So we're talking about Mythros's plan. So in the first half of the season, we have Mythros going around first, recruiting Fingon, right? And then Mythros and Fingon working together at the summit in order to convince people that this thing is a go. And one of the things there are a couple things that we talked about here. One is that there needs to be a plan A and a plan B, right? Yes. A plan A that includes, because their pitch is for everybody to be involved, for Nargothrond to come in, for Doriath to come in, all of the elves to come together into this battle. And so plan A has to include that whole cast, right? And then we need a plan B for when Nargothrond and Doriath don't come in. And of course, Mithros is not a fool, right? He's going to have plan B well worked out, because he's got to know that the odds are comparatively slim that both Nargothrond and Doriath. So it's not like Nargothrond and Doriath are going to walk out and he's going to be like, well, there goes my whole plan. Now I've got to go back to the drawing board. Right. So, so to some extent, having both of those things, kind of thought through in advance, I think is clearly a thing that we're going to have to do. So that's one thing, one of the elements there, but the other element is that it not only has to be a good plan, it has to be ideally we want it to be something that kind of picks up on clues from previous seasons, right that look like we've been setting up for this. So in particular, the thing that comes primarily to mind here is the Fingolfin's attack and the aftermath of Fingolfin's attack, right? That is like the perceived weakness of Morgoth, or at least the hope that he's not as unassailable as you know it might have seemed that he was. So if there are ways in which we can, and I don't just mean these as like plot points, like that there are things that have been learned. I just mean like as far as the shape of it, right? Like the implication that, if we can make this feel like this is the natural follow-up from Fingolfin's attack, that Fingolfin's desperate and not quite suicidal assault was itself only the foretaste of this moment. Like, that was what this was, you know, or rather, this is what that was pointing to, right? Mm. Then that will, I think, help to have our audience feel like the momentum of the entire show is leading up to victory at the end of season 7.
Right. We would not want this to look like it came out of nowhere, because that would be suspicious.
Yes.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Their plan has to be a good one. The response from Thangorodrim also has to be good.
Mm-hmm.
And the way that our guys react to things, with a few exceptions, have to make sense,
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
right? So when, so obviously there's certain G elves are going to make some mistakes, but that's a pretty understandable one,
mm-hmm.
and it's important to keep in mind that every time that the elves have met the orcs on the field, they've just obliterated them.
Yes.
So there's no reason for them to suspect that anything different is going to happen now.
Yeah, all of the reasons for concern on the part of the elves are things like the dragon,
mm-hmm.
right? Sometimes the wolves have been hard to handle, right? Those have caused problems, especially like out for Círdan, very memorably, right? That is like many of the auxiliaries have been a problem, but mere like we have a big army of orcs in the field has never, and the Balrogs obviously have been an issue. But
there has to be some supernatural element.
Yeah, yeah.
For it to actually threaten the elves.
Yes, yes. And the dragon was a big problem at the last battle. I mean, that was the real issue. Now, of course, you've also mentioned yet another reason for the flexibility of the plan. It not only has to be able to accommodate a quick pivot to plan B with Nargothrond, without Nargothrond and Doriath, but also to be able to accommodate the pivot in the other direction with the addition of the Easterlings and the dwarves.
Right.
And Gondolin.
And Gondolin, yeah.
Well,
I mean, honestly.
Gondolin should appear like the turn, because at that point, it should kind of feel to the audience that this is not looking super great.
Mm-hmm.
And one thing that we could do is, as happens in the book, tell part of the story from the perspective of the Western Front, and then kind of slide back in time a little bit to tell Maedhros' story, why Maedhros is late,
mm-hmm.
which Tolkien does in the mm-hmm. in the book. He doesn't give us a lot of detail as to what happened. Like when they say that he was delayed,
yes, how
it never explains
right.
how
yes.
that happened.
Yes.
Because then after, like, when Maedhros finally does show up, the Easterlings then fall on them from the rear. So it's not like they, like, what were they doing? Were all of the Easterlings, like, grabbing onto an elvish
right,
foot?
Right, and hauling them from behind.
The Noldor
yes.
were just,
yeah.
like a pair of toddlers?
Probably not.
Probably no. not. But that's actually always been one of the questions that I've been curious about. When I read that passage, I'm like, what did they do to delay
that? But I have an idea for that.
Okay.
We can get into that.
Yeah.
So essentially, the whole way, the good guys have to not look stupid.
Yes,
the leadership of the good guys are going to have to not look stupid.
Yes,
Windor can look stupid, foolish.
Foolish, yes.
Fae,
right.
In fact,
Fae, yes.
Right. Yeah, but understandably, right. But
yes.
that doesn't make what he did any smarter.
Right.
But. You know, once that happens, then Finrod and Turgon are kind of in the situation like, okay, so now we have to do this thing. Like, now we're committed.
Mm-hmm.
And good guys can, as you say, excuse me, as you say, Dylan, good guys can look like jerks. The Feanorians sure enough are.
Right. Yes. Yeah. That is okay. Though again, yeah, the challenge is we don't want either side looking stupid.
Right.
Really.
Right.
Again, Gothmog is not brilliant. But
he has to at least look competent.
Right. In the field, he needs to be competent.
Right.
And he's not the one calling the shots. Right. I mean,
right.
The
strategic shots.
Right. The strategic. Ideally, we want the plan to be unfolding and then to watch unfold a brilliant counter plan against mm-hmm. the plan that they had.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
And that's the part where they don't know how much Angband knows about what they've been up to.
Yes.
But Angband knows what they've been up to.
Yes.
And that should become quite clear when things are set up waiting
and,
for them.
And
right. It's not no one in Angband is being taken by surprise by
right.
this
yes.
attack.
Yes.
Yes.
And I think that the best way to illustrate that is the resolution of Anael's plot line here. Because he can say, look, like he can tell his son, in fact, don't go.
Right.
Because this is going to end horribly. I'm not allowed in the councils of anybody anymore. But even I can feel the weight
mm-hmm.
of Morgoth's influence, and I cannot be the only one that's affected.
Right.
There are others. And of course, Anael's son, whose name escapes me at the
Elrun.
Moment. Yeah, Elrun. He kind of dismisses this as you're just, like, I can't believe anything you say.
Mm-hmm.
Nothing you say is trustworthy at this point. I'm going to do my duty.
Right.
You know, you do what...
Yeah. Yeah. Anael's exile is part of the story of this season.
Yeah.
Because it's self-imposed, obviously.
Yes.
And he can't be part of any of this.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
Are we including any of the story of how exactly Morgoth finds out about the plan?
I don't think we... have to. It should be enough that he has.
Yeah, I mean, we've certainly laid the foundation that there are, you know, of what
yeah.
he is doing to elves, both that he's captured and released. That he, I mean, mm. we've set up all of those things over the course of the last
exactly.
few years.
Exactly. So I don't think we need to show it again now, and we will have the opportunity next season with the story of Hurin to show what Morgoth actually knows and what
right.
Morgoth can actually do.
Exactly.
And I feel like the reveal at that time will
yeah.
be more impactful
right.
than seeing
right.
putting the cards on the table now. I
right.
feel
and there
like...
are so many characters in play in this season.
Yes.
To try to keep because up with we would band. Have to also be inventing new elvish characters only to reveal that they are in fact bad guys all along.
Right.
And that's
right.
Not great anyway. So yeah.
Yeah, okay. I think we let the suspicion fall on Rogren, who does take part in the war and is an escaped prisoner just like Anile. They escaped together.
Yes.
Mm.
So if Anile is untrustworthy and has to be exiled, and Rogren is sitting in on these war councils, someone's got to go, wait a minute.
Yes.
Right.
This feels dumb. And that suspicion lets us know, like, oh, right, there are actually spies in this group somewhere.
Mm-hmm.
Right. Mm-hmm. Even if it's not Rogren.
And we could have something of a subplot where Elrun might kind of look over at Rogren and be like, wait a minute. That guy...
Didn't you escape with Dad? Like, yeah. Yeah.
And have it resolve with Rogren, like, saving his life at some point or something like that.
Well,
indicating that, in fact...
Speaking of people who are going to die in this battle...
Yeah.
Elrun is one of Fingon's right-hand guys.
Right. Yeah.
So guess who's going to get killed by a Balrog during this battle?
Yeah.
Elrun.
Yeah, that's fair.
Or a troll. I mean, obviously the trolls are with the Balrogs at that time. Yeah. But the point is he's going to die with Fingon.
One thing that Professor Tolkien writes about in this battle that I'm kind of really resistant to is he kind of describes this the line of the Noldor and the men of Dor Lomen extending all the way from Barad Ethel all the way down to the Tol Sirion, essentially.
To the path,
and I'm just like, no, because then the 10,000 people that Turgon shows up with are a drop in the bucket.
Mm-hmm.
Like, that's a 2 million man front minimum.
It's a long ways.
Yeah. So I'm a big no on that one.
Yeah.
I do think that we can preserve some of the notes from the text where an earthworks can have been constructed at the foot of the causeway from Barad Ethel to allow a larger army to issue out onto the to stage a larger army out on the field rather than having to march them all down swiftly into line of battle from the causeway, because that sounds like a terrible way to do that.
Right.
And
there is that mountain range there, so
yeah.
We can put the armies at the foot of the mountains. It doesn't need to stretch all the way to the gap.
No. But what I mean is that needs to kind of be a protected zone.
Sure.
Down there at the foot of the causeway for them to stage from. Also, it describes the men of Hithlum as being on the right, and I'm just going to interpret that as them taking possession of the earthworks at the Fens of Sirion, which have been turned backwards and forwards a number of times at this point. But that allows it to make perfect sense that they wind up retreating to that point.
That's where they started from, yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
And it allows us to have an actual interaction between Hurin, Hur, and Turgon when Turgon shows up.
Mm-hmm.
Because he will have to pass right by them to get there.
Right. Right. Okay, well, let's see. So,
but should we start with the first step?
Yeah, let's start with the first steps.
Let's
not leave the live dragon out of our calculations. So first, the Dorthonian campaign. And the problem here is twofold, right?
Mm-hmm.
A, the dragon proved himself to be the most unstoppable weapon on the field in the last battle. So he has to be dealt with somehow or other. There's got to be a plan for him.
And unfortunately, we have left him in Dorthonian, which has caused this problem.
Well, and the other problem is that he is right behind your lines, right?
Right.
So of all of the places for the worst weapon in the enemy's arsenal to be, for him to be right on the back side of your lines is just about the worst possible positioning. So the first phase of the battle has to be dealing with Glaurung. So, of course, the description of Glaurung and his conflict with the dwarves and being stabbed by Azakal and stuff is obviously a storyline that we're looking to preserve. But what we've been talking about doing already so far is kind of temporally separating it and geographically separating it from the rest. So it's not just a thing that happens on the field in the middle of the battle sort of randomly, but it's a thing that happens at it's the first stage, because again, you can't even go into battle. You can't even form up against Morgoth's forces, you know, against Thangorodrim in the north. If the dragon is going to emerge,
that a dragon is going to fall on you from behind. And just demolish you. Yeah,
exactly.
Right. Right. So by moving that, what we have done is instead of making it two pieces of like do something to deal with the dragon, and then when he does attack, have the storyline with Azaghal. By putting it all together in one, it's neater, but it does disappear that. Like, oh no, the dragon arrived on the battlefield. This is devastating. Mm-hmm. Followed by, but Azaghal has wounded him, and the dragon retreats. Yes. But Azaghal died. So like, the ups and downs are pretty high in the way the story is told in the first place. So by removing it and putting it in the very beginning of the battle, we're gonna flatten some of that out.
Right.
Because I mean, we will.
Yes.
So we'll have to make sure that. Whatever note that ends on, the highs and lows of it are enough to get us started to go into the battle and still have some ups and downs later.
Yep.
Like we will have to do something else.
I have an idea to alleviate that somewhat.
Yeah, there's things we can do, but I'm just reminding that by making that change, that's the main impact on the storytelling is the highs and lows.
That's been my concern as I've been thinking about this.
I will say that, although of course I acknowledge that concern, I would also say that there is an upside of isolating it in the way that we have, even just apart from the rationale that we're using to do it. But in addition, we plan to fill in some of the gaps that the text is leaving, especially in regard to the Easterlings and their involvement. Mm-hmm. And the involvement of like Galadriel. And I mean, there's like several other dimensions that we're planning we're going to have not only more description of what the Easterlings do and why, but we already are bringing into this, because of the backstory that we're building up through the season, a much more nuanced sense of like who the Easterlings are and factions within the Easterlings and their own different perspectives. In other words, there's a lot of like narrative work to be done in the middle of that. And I think that a certain amount of focus is actually going to be a really good thing when it comes to that.
We won't feel that the Eastern Front is empty by moving the dragon out of it. I don't think
at all. Yeah.
It was more of the, I want to make sure that we pay attention to all the turns in this battle.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Because there should be a lot of them.
Yes.
And if we smooth out too much, then we lose part of what makes the story what it is.
Yes. Exactly.
But I don't think we're going to not have surprising ups and downs with the Easterlings and the betrayal in the East. That should also have plenty of.
I'm much more concerned about the impact of the ups and downs in the Glaurung segment. Mm. That is much more concerning to me, because instead of the appearance of the dragon being this horrific thing that occurs in the middle of this already not going great battle, it is in fact something that we are anticipating, expecting to happen. We are planning on interacting with the dragon.
Right. It just takes the legs right out from under.
Right. Yeah. So what we have to do is we have to add some elements of surprise back into the story.
Yeah.
In order to get that kind of impact.
Yeah. Though again, I would also add, I think that the increased anticipation, that is, we will be spending much more time building up the dragon and what a big deal it is. And yes, that's a different impact than, oh my gosh, the dragon is charging, right? I mean, that's a different effect. But I don't think it is, in the end, a lesser effect to have, you know, the dragon be looming large and, you know, building this, having this weight of doubt and anxiety and concern leading up to this first fit. Because in a lot of ways, right, I mean, everyone really has to be feeling. If we screw up, like, neutralizing the dragon is not going to be trivial, no matter how it is we try to do it. Right. And if we screw this up, we're hosed. Like, game over. Like, the whole battle thing is dead in the water if we can't neutralize the dragon. So, so in that way, there's this a great deal of tension and pressure that we're putting on it that it really doesn't have in the book. It does have that one shock effect, right?
Yes.
But I do think anyway.
And like the effect of the dwarves leaving the battlefield is definitely going to it would definitely have more impact if it was happening at the tail end of the battle proper. Yes. There's no question about it.
Yeah.
But I think that by doing it here, we can also, it gives us more time to contextualize it, especially if, as we've discussed, the Dwarven Corps of Engineers still stays.
Yes.
Because their task isn't yet completed. So if their attitude is like, look, fighting alongside you, that was Azaghal's thing. We're not going to do that in the same way. But we'll still fulfill our end of the bargain at this point.
Yeah. Okay, so the Dorthonian campaign itself. Mm. So Mithros is the one with the plan.
Yes.
Right?
Yes, and as you pointed out, if you don't deal with the dragon, there is no viable plan of attacking Angband. So if he's proposed the plan to, hey, let's go attack Angband in the first place, he has to have a plan to deal with the dragon from the beginning.
Yes.
And we don't need to tell the audience the first time he talks to his brothers about the plan, or even when he talks to Fingon about the plan. Mm-hmm. Like, we don't have to let on what the plan is as far as the audience is concerned, but it needs to be very clear that there is one, and of course we need to know what that is, because he's going to say it at the council, or the summit meeting. He's going to share that plan with the gathered people of, like, here's how we're going to deal with the dragon.
Mm. Right. Okay, so have we... So what are our theories about the plan? We've talked about the possibility of trying to trap him. We've talked about the possibilities of hunting him, trying to kill him. Now, Nick, you weren't there for that conversation. Did you have...
No.
Do you have views on this?
Yeah, I've been thinking about this. And one thing that... So the dragon is kind of centered at Rivel's Well, right?
Yes. Mm-hmm.
That's where his brood are. And I think at this point, if Mithros has done any kind of good intel gathering, they know at this point that the baby dragons are there. At this point, teenage dragons, you know.
Yes, yes.
Right? So what I've been thinking is that because they don't just have to get rid of Glaurung. The Dorthonion itself is also infested.
Mm-hmm.
And so what I think is going to wind up happening is they're going to make a push into Lodhros over the spur of mountains, the spur of the eastern mountains there, and make first contact with the orcs of Dorthonion.
In Lodhros. This is your first little map, right?
Right, yes. Yeah.
Okay.
And they are super successful. The orcs are not able to stand against them.
Right, they can drive off the orcs. That shouldn't be hard.
So they drive them down, and so now Mithros is now following the path of the Lodhros refugees, which takes them, as we discussed, to like a high point behind what used to be the lines of the Sons of Finarfin, north of Rivel's Well. But before they go there, what I'm thinking is that the dwarves do a forced march through the hills across the northern edge of Dorthonion,
right,
with the intention of... So what Mithros is trying to do is he's trying to draw Glaurung out to lead the orcs and giving the dwarves the opportunity to come in from behind and slaughter the young dragons, the baby dragon. Take them off the board.
Okay.
Right? And then once they're done, they'll be able to come around and attack Glaurung from the rear, and they're going to be able to actually take him down in this pitched battle scenario. And they'll be able to get his orcs and him all in one fell swoop. However, Glaurung catches on that his brood is in danger. Right, so this is, again, we're bringing the surprise back into the scenario. And so before the dwarves can get to them, he turns around and heads north, abandons his army, heads north, and lays into the dwarves. Desperate battle ensues. He's wounded, and it's got to be more than just like a pinprick. It's got to be like a gaping wound. So he takes off. He manages to collect his brood and they head to points north. I don't think we're going to see him at any point in the rest of the battle, but I think the point at which Angband is emptied and like it when it describes him coming out, I think that we can see the younger dragons coming out as part of, mm-hmm. but they're not the same. They don't have the same impact, right?
Yeah.
It's just part of the horribleness. And of course the dwarves march off the field as stated in the book. And I think that will allow us to get that kind of ride out of that.
So the section plan, of the battle. The plan with Glaurung himself then.
Mm-hmm.
So I can see how this plan will defeat his orc armies, which is not a huge challenge. Yeah. How it will destroy his brood and cleanse Rivel's well. Mm-hmm. As far as killing him, all we're still doing is just ganging up on him and trying to beat him up. I mean, there's.
Well, that's what their intention is.
Yeah. Yeah.
But it doesn't pan out that way. It rounds up being desperate situation.
Exactly. So, but the issue with that
is that we've had opportunities to try to take out Glaurung in the past, and no one was remotely successful.
Yes.
So the plan can't just be, well, we're just going to go fight the dragon. There has to be another piece to it. Either there's a new piece of intelligence about we understand dragons better now and he has a weakness, small expensive.
There has to be
scale.
Convenient thrush around.
Right. Yeah, if there's some kind of, oh, the dragon has a weakness, let's exploit it, then it's one thing.
Right.
But if it's just, we're just going to meet him in battle, well, we know what that looks like. And so far, every time that has looked like the dragon wiped the floor with everyone.
So the answer to that is actually in the Dwarvish Corps of Engineers. It's Ballista. Is what I would use in that situation. We're not even talking about a flying dragon here. Like, they can hit him. And they can hit him with, like, massive spear-sized bolts at, like,
that distance.
75 miles an hour.
Right. But the dwarves who came over the mountains up behind wouldn't have these with them.
No, they're commandos, right?
Yeah.
They're prepared for fire-breathing dragons, but they're not necessarily prepared to fight the father of dragons in a pitched battle. And it come and they win, but at a great cost.
Okay, so the trap then. I'm trying to think from Mythros's perspective here. Thinking of Mythros and what Mythros would think about Glaurung. Because if there is one thing, I'm mindful, Marie, of what you're saying about like knowing dragons better, right?
Mm.
It's not just that they now have made a closer study of like dragon physiology or something like that. They have interacted with Glaurung himself on numerous occasions. Like they have profiled him a little bit right now. And I would think that one of the things that Mythros would, I'm remembering the experience with Glaurung,
and Caranthir.
Yeah, exactly. Mm-hmm. I mean, not just Caranthir's experience, but when he came and attacked the castle, I mean, like, he was...
Gap.
Yeah, at Magor's Gap. He is... I think that Mythros would think Glaurung is arrogant and overconfident. He likes to brag. He likes to chat. Remember, he was daring them to come attack
him? He wants to get him monologuing.
Yes, he wants to get him monologuing. So, so what about this? I mean, I like the ballista thing. Like, that's a resource that they, a military resource they have now in their alliance with the dwarves that they didn't have before. And it also makes the whole thing a little bit more dwarf-centric, which is fun. So they can lay essentially a trap. Glaurung doesn't know about these either, right?
Right.
So, again, I'm looking at your map here. They're coming in from the south, right?
Mm-hmm.
They would come to it. So they would choose a place, like, you know, a valley or something, where they could place the, you know, up high on the sides, right?
Mm-hmm.
And then the Feanorians would form up.
Yeah.
So I think what they would want
to
do is...
Mithros would feign to treat with him.
He would come out front. He would challenge him. Yeah. He would come out front and challenge, because Mithros himself didn't fight Glaurung personally.
Yeah.
Like, he didn't personally fight with him before.
It's going to be so disappointing when he doesn't, though.
Right. So I think we should stage this, like, really awesome challenge where he, like, walks out into the front of his army and, like, and so Glaurung can see. And so what he would see is this strong force of Feanorians formed up against him with Mithros, their leader in the front, challenging him to battle. The Feanorians would be looking arrogant as well.
Mm-hmm.
But he, Glaurung, would have a comparatively small opinion of them because he's mopped the floor with them before, as you said. But he didn't get to fight Mithros, and he would certainly submit to the temptation at least to come and monologue with him, and then probably to, like, you know, to teach them another lesson.
Yeah, this could be a great opportunity for some great Glaurung dialogue.
Yes. But the goal is just to bring him in and then stick him full of arrows, right?
Yeah. Right.
And to say that everything should build on what came earlier, this is shaping up to look a lot like Mithros meeting Sauron in exchange for Silmaril.
Yes.
And, you know, there was deception in that meeting.
Yes.
And didn't end well for Mithros. But this should be reminiscent of that.
Right.
Also,
and Mithros is doing to Glaurung what Sauron did to him.
Exactly.
Yeah. Yes.
But it would also work well if all along Mithros is saying to people, let me deal with the dragon.
Yes.
My God, Marie.
He's like, I personally am dealing with this dragon.
Yes.
Marie, that's amazing.
So that would be the way to do it.
Pretty well.
Yes.
Yeah. So I do like where that is going. And the fact that it never happens is a disappointment. But at the same time, like, Mithros does live on account of not facing the dragon.
And it also helps that now it's at least a slightly more, like, at least a few layers of HP have been shaved off of Glaurung by the time he gets to the dwarves in the north.
But, like, how we could get anticlimactic about that. If because he can't
figure out this is a trap and leave.
Yeah, he can't absolutely go into the trap, or else he will get shot full of bolts. So, because at some point, instead of charging down into they're not going to wound him or kill him this way.
Mm.
Instead, he's going to figure it out, and he's going to turn around and bolt.
It would be interesting if he kind of outwits Mithros in a way.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I'm okay with that, especially in this situation. Especially as he's talking to him, Mithros reveals just a little too much.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
Right. The whole thing with Bilbo and talking to a dragon is that it's very dangerous to talk to a dragon. Like, that is a mistake here.
Yes.
Right.
Yes.
And so I think it can cost Mithros something if he takes that path.
Azaghal something.
Well, Azaghal's going to pay the price, but...
Yes.
How often do the Feanorians actually pay the price for their own mistakes? It's almost always falling on somebody else.
Which is why people don't really like making alliances with them.
Right.
But speaking of that, the dwarves. How early in the storyline do we want the dwarves involved with the alliance?
Mm.
Because if this is the plan that Mithros is taking to the summit, he needs to already have some dwarven involvement, even if it's only at the level of the dwarves have provided weapons that will damage a dragon.
Yes.
That would be enough. Like, he doesn't necessarily have to say he has an army of dwarves yet, but he has to have something if that's the plan he's taking to the council. So if he doesn't have that, he has to have another
plan. Yeah. So, by the way, you guys had been discussing the whole question of dwarvish mortality and whatnot.
Mm-hmm.
And I agree with your conclusion that we cannot continue with the idea that the dwarves are maintaining this illusion any further.
The illusion, yeah.
Right. So what I think would be actually really, really cool is to just blow the whole thing wide open. Rather than it being kind of an open secret that they've been lying to the elves the whole time.
Right.
We can hint that the elves have kind of suspected this all along.
Mm-hmm.
But if the dwarves come to meet with Maedhros, and his contact person, his guy from the Dagor Bragalach, is kind of taking the lead in the discussion, and then a younger dwarf kind of speaks up very confidently, and Maedhros is kind of almost a little dismissive towards him, I don't know you, but I have a good relationship with Azaghal, your king. He gave me this awesome knife and this awesome helmet, all the stuff. And it turns out that it's Azaghal. And Azaghal says, "I am Azaghal. My father it was who gave you those things." And I think that would be a really good dramatic moment. And the Feanorns can kind of look at each other like, that's what we've been kind of.
Right, that tracks.
Kind of make it. Right, and you can kind of make it as, because they don't we never knew we can kind of maintain some plausible deniability that not all the elves have figured this out,
mm-hmm.
and that but they have, some of them have kind of suspected this for a while, so they don't look stupid. Everybody kind of comes out looking like they're kind of smart.
Mm-hmm.
And Azaghal comes out as a canny but bold leader in this situation, and I think that builds him up as the character who is going to say, we're going to go to war for the first time, we're going to take this threat from Morgoth seriously, and we're going to fight alongside our allies.
Yes.
And as you guys were saying, his personal leadership is what's driving that. So it makes perfect sense that when he's killed, that kind of falls apart.
It will also help to convey convey more about the sense of loss with Azaghal's death, right?
Yes.
Because he is young. He is a young king. And he is he's the prodigy. Like, they have high hopes for Azaghal, that he's going to be one of the greatest kings they have had. The greatest king since, their Durin. The original Azaghal.
The first Azaghal the First, yes.
Azaghal the First, yeah. It is he is
Azaghal the First, come again.
Come again, exactly. Yeah. Right, yes. And then for him to die young, on this battlefield will be felt as a real loss, and something which then, and I definitely like Maedhros and the others to be in a position to see that, to feel the weight of that.
Yeah.
Okay. So we have to be cautious with the, I'm having a little bit of a hard time with the, not the springing of the trap, but the non-springing of the trap.
Right.
Because I feel if Glaurung gets close enough to have a dialogue with Maedhros, he's surely got to be in ballista range, right?
Yes. Yeah.
So how does he avoid the trap? And yet, I mean, not having that scene, would seem horrible, but...
Right. So the only way that I can think of is that the dwarves have to get into position while the conversation is taking place, and that while they're getting into position, Maedhros is just about to spring the trap, right? Also, he has to have an exit strategy, because he's got to, he's the guy. This whole thing's going to fall apart without him, so he can't actually
Get killed by the dragon.
Get killed by the dragon, right? maybe he goes in with a dwarf mask just to be on the safe side.
I would think, though, see, I don't want to give up on the idea that Mithras, at least, believes that he's got a chance against the dragon.
Okay. Okay.
And so, that I think we could believe that.
Yeah. So let's say then that he does prepare. He gets fully armed up in dwarvish gear. And this is part of the tip-off, though, right? So Glaurung is talking to them. They're monologuing at each other, right? And Glaurung starts waxing poetic about you with your dwarvish armor and your dwarvish weapons. And there's no dwarves among you, but I definitely smell dwarves.
And no one knows the smell of dwarves better than
I. Right, yeah. Well, I don't know about that at this point. But but he hears the screams of the brood. Immediately picks up on the trap. We see him see the ballista.
And he's gone.
Orcs. Right? So leaving his army of orcs to get completely obliterated.
So here... Here's a thought. I just thought of a way to get him in voice range without having to fire on him. Right.
Okay.
What if Glaurung counters by approaching from a completely different direction?
Yeah. So I was going to say, one thing that Glaurung does with Nienor is he's wrapped around the hill and then his head's on top of the hill,
mm-hmm.
right? And that's unexpected.
Yes.
Like, and Nienor walks out of the fog and there's a dragon head.
And there's right a dragon there. Head right there. Yeah, exactly.
So I feel like we should do something yes. with the terrain.
That's what I was thinking. Because one of the other things, one of the limitations of the ballista is you can't aim them way up, right? So what if, like, basically they kind of set up in like a box canyon, right? And they have the ballista on the side. But the whole idea is that Glaurung is going to come down the canyon, charge down the canyon at them. Right.
Right.
And that's what Mithras is preparing for. But instead,
he comes down the wall.
Yeah. On the far side. And so they can't. So the ballista that are right beneath him can't do anything at all. The ones on the far side still can't. Like, he's too high for them to aim at. And now this is recoverable, though, because all Mithras has to get him to do is charge down. Like, that's not the angle they were expecting him from, but they still have a shot if they can get him down into the canyon. But he just has to get to the canyon floor where they can shoot him. And so Mithras' challenge at this point is now just to draw him down. And he can almost succeed, but then Glaurung veers off and goes in the other direction.
And goes back up the canyon wall.
Back up the canyon wall, yeah.
Which reminds the audience that the canyon maybe wasn't a great trap idea for a dragon.
Right.
Well,
or,
that is how they got him the first time
when he was young.
Yeah.
But my point is that we want to see that there was a little bit of a tenuous nature to this whole trap all along.
Yes.
Because we still want Glaurung to be very dangerous the next time he's on screen.
Yes.
Yeah. Yes.
And of course, a canyon trap is going to be involved in Glaurung's death eventually, anyway.
Right. Yeah.
So. But not drawing him into the
right.
Canyon,
so right.
It'll be different. Yeah.
He can kill some of the dwarvish corps of engineers on his way out, too.
Conceivably, yes.
Right.
Yes.
And, of course, pass right by our two dwarvish working class characters.
Right.
Like, again, for the second time.
The second time.
And they're just like...
right. Right. Our close encounter crew, yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
Like, we're getting in the two guys in Pirates of the Caribbean. The one of them is there's a whole bit in I think the second one where the question of who's going to be captain is an open question, and so I think it's Rigetti steps in and says and makes it appear as if he is going to claim the captaincy, and the other two guys just look at him like, and he's just terrified immediately.
Right. Sorry. Yeah. So I think that we can have a trap that doesn't spring, but the audience still sees that there was a trap there.
Yeah.
And that Glaurung was in threat from these weapons. And Glaurung's intelligence and unpredictability is what lets him avoid the trap. which is good. Like, that preserves Glaurung's character. And the idea that he somehow knows and senses that the little baby dragons are in danger is good. Like, that's a sufficient cause to make him leave.
Yes.
I think.
Right.
So I think that will all add up.
And just to make sure that nobody misses what the trap was, like, he just... he has to come down far enough for them, like, as he's getting out, for them to shoot at him and miss, right? Because he's not coming in the direction they were planning and everything.
Well, he's moving laterally to them now. So
exactly.
It's really hard for them to kind of...
Yeah, yeah. I mean, they're not super maneuverable.
So this is basically like cannons.
Yes.
Yes.
That you're like
turbo lasers. They're turbo lasers, and he's an X-Wing. He's moving too fast laterally. They're not able
yes,
to track
exactly.
him.
Yes, exactly.
Exactly. Gotcha.
It's just like that. Yep. So,
once again, Glaurung, close air support.
That's it. And now Mythros, meanwhile, sees the trap failing, sees what Glaurung is doing, immediately is like, oh,
orders
man,
the charge.
So he and the Feanorians come charging up behind. So they're right behind Glaurung.
Yes.
Now there's like no plan. It's now just like Mythros desperate.
Right. So
like,
he
attack.
They plow into the army of orcs that had been assembled. The orcs immediately rout.
Yeah. Yeah.
But of course, they're routing towards
the
fact,
dwarves.
The orcs fled before his face.
Right, exactly. Yes. Oh, it's going to be everything that you ever wanted that to look like is what that's going to look like.
Good.
And they flee right into the arms of the dwarves, but the dwarves have problems of their own. So... these are in fact the orcs that get out of the way when the dwarves march off with their fallen leader and the as Glaurung, who has got to have like a gaping gash.
Yes,
like he looks like he's bleeding out.
Yes,
you know, and he's like one of his arms is barely functional.
Right. Yeah, this is the Shelob retreats from Samwise scenario of
yes.
That was a pretty serious wound. Like, clearly not dead, but at the same time, definitely not going to keep fighting at this point.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yep.
Yeah.
Yeah. Definitely. Yes. Yeah. And I think that one of the things that's really great about setting up the conflict with Glaurung in this way is that we can actually do it in such a way as to build up Mythros.
Right.
Because I don't think, I mean, I love the way, Marie, you were suggesting about building it up, building, you know, but, you know, making it sound like his plan is merely to challenge Glaurung to single combat, essentially.
Yeah.
Like, that's the plan, right? He's the plan. Or at least that's the impression that we get, is that, you know, he thinks that he's the plan. But the thing is, like, that is part of the plan. Like, he is willing to fight Glaurung, and, you know, and especially if that's what's needed in order to draw him out and get him.
Right.
I mean, he's got to realize that. Glaurung might not get shot enough before he can get to him, right? I mean,
yes.
that like there is going to be fighting of the dragon that's going to be needed.
Right. But it'll be a lot easier if the dragon has already been kind of turned
yes.
into being pushed
and
in.
If he can be getting continually shot during the fight. Because the chances of with the size differential, the chances of friendly fire are relatively low.
Yeah.
But the point is, Mythros is in fact also challenging Glaurung, and when the plan goes awry, he literally, like, his plan B literally is to charge Glaurung and fight him rather than have him slaughter the dwarves, but he's too late.
Right. And he's and Mythros is, in my opinion, he's definitely he's in the top five Elvish fighters.
Totally.
For sure. If not number two, He's for sure in the top five. I think Fingolfin is definitely number one, and then Mythros is way up there.
Yeah, I don't see any reason not to have him number two, frankly.
Right.
I mean,
Fingon is a contender.
Fingon is a contender, but he doesn't need to be. It doesn't need to be higher.
Fingolfin,
right.
Mythros, Fingon, probably Caranthir and Kelegorm. I think that they're definitely in the top five.
I don't know.
As the way that the book describes them.
Maybe.
The
I put Mablung up there too, but anyway.
Yeah, I was going to say, Beleg and Mablung should at least get
a
consideration.
Yeah, but they're not.
I know, Noldor. They're not Noldor. I know.
They never saw the light of the trees.
I know.
So therefore, they're just not as good as everybody else.
They're almost there.
They saw Thingolimellion.
Exactly. I would say Thingol's probably in the top five.
Think how much FaceTime Mabung's been getting with Melian for all these centuries. Yeah. Come on, you know, I mean,
exactly. It's almost as good as Thingol.
He's got to be at least, at least a demi Caliquendi at this point, right?
Yeah. Well, the gray elves, light exactly. elves, dark elves, gray elves. Like, it's very clear.
Exactly. Yeah.
But
the Melian effect.
I think that Thingol is definitely, you know, amongst the greatest warriors of the. The elves as well. I mean, he's the tallest person that ever lived.
That counts for something.
The wingspan's got to count
Imagine
for something.
Imagine the reach.
Exactly.
Yeah.
As someone who's 5'7", on a great day, reach will hurt you.
It's true.
It is, however, much easier to strike someone's torso when you're, like, short.
I got to tell you.
You got to get past... But you gotta get past the jab, though.
I'm aware.
But once you do, man, I gotta tell you, as a tall person who does martial arts, boy, short people inside your range, there's nothing. Helpless. You're helpless. It's a helpless feeling.
There, it's fine.
Short, quick person inside your reach, nothing you can do. Yeah.
But the problem is not getting hit on the head before you get
exactly.
Close.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Do we think the having seen the light of the trees helps with that?
Totally, yeah, absolutely. No, it affects everything, right? It affects
just the effect there. Yeah.
You get a general buff to every stat.
Yeah, to every stat, exactly, okay. Including height.
Yes,
but
anyway. So my question now is, how much of this plan is Mithras going to share at the summit? Because he can't honestly get up in front of everybody who's gathered and be like, "Don't worry, you guys, I." Personally, we'll take out that dragon.
Well, he's,
and have
he's
everyone
saying,
be like,
look,
okay, you do that.
But the thing is that none of the plan is going to happen until that's happened.
I know.
Nobody is going to commit to this until...
Right. So I know he has to present it as, I am going to deal with the dragon in Dorthonion before we even set foot on the battlefield. So no one needs to respond to the call until Dorthonion is... handled, so I will handle it. And it's clearly he means like the Feanorians will handle it.
Right.
And like that's fine. The part where then it's him personally is kind of fun. But I'm wondering if people are buying into this. If he's just like, don't worry, you guys, we're totally gonna take out that dragon and retake Dorthonion.
Yeah.
Like, you and what army? Like like we already saw the dragon decimate, in fact, your army.
Hey, he decimated your armies first.
Maybe people don't want to ask too many questions about it.
Well, I think
that you're going to do the dragon? All right, great. Good luck with
that.
That's
all yours, buddy.
I think we
found a solution to our Feanorian problem.
But the reality is that on TV, we don't actually have to show him convincing the guys that this is he has a plan and this is what the plan is and this is how it's going to work.
No.
All
I'm
we have
wondering...
to do is show is give the audience some breadcrumbs. Like all that has to happen is he says, I'll handle the dragon. Boom. Cut. Right. He can have explained himself at that point. But as long as we've already started laying the groundwork for the alliance with the dwarves at that point, I don't think we have too much of a problem. As long as it just doesn't come out of nowhere.
So the alliance with the dwarves obviously has multiple steps. There's the recruiting of the Dwarven Corps of Engineers.
Yep. Mm-hmm.
There's Azaghal being on board with fighting personally.
Mm-hmm.
And then they have to all actually show up. At the time of the summit, which is fairly early in the season, where are we on that diplomatic thing? Because I know that one of the issues is that if the dwarves join very early, it's Mithras, the awesome diplomat, invited the dwarves and they joined.
Right.
Like that is the story.
Right.
But if we want it to be Azaghal, up and coming young king, has convinced the people of Belagos that they need to join this new venture, that feels like it needs to be a dwarf centric decision, not
Yes.
Mithras had a plan, reached out and said, "Hey guys, want to join?" And they're like, "Yes, we want to join your party." Like,
so what we can do is have the Dwarven Corps of Engineers already committed at this point. And because That means that at this point, his plan is, we march out, I draw the dragon out by challenging him to personal physical combat, and I have my dwarven ballista ready to go to start pouring damage into him from the sides. If I got to take a little heat, that's fine.
Right. But, so the initial plan is a feasible plan without the dwarf army going behind to get the big dragon.
Right, because they could potentially, especially with the help of the dwarvish ballista, deal with the dragon population of Rivel's Well after Glaurung himself is dead.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
That raises my second question then, mm-hmm. or my last question really.
Okay.
Why is the double attack necessary? Why not spring the trap, kill Glaurung, then go mop up the wormlings?
Right. That's fair. Because the plan, this is a backup. Like, it's a backup of a backup of a backup, and it turns out that it was necessary. Right? So therefore, we're showing Myvros' plan didn't necessarily fail. It went into the contingencies that he had already prepared. Right? He was not planning for Glaurung to kill a bunch of the dwarves. Right? But when the dwarvish army proper leaves, he's like, okay, that's not great that was the consequence of the way this went down, but that is an acceptable loss.
Okay.
In return for the taking out of the dragon.
I have an idea about this related to what Marie was just saying. Azaghal comes and says, we can kill the dragon.
Okay.
We're not afraid of the dragon. We have this anti-dragon gear, right? Yeah, we know he messed you guys up the last time, but you didn't have us and you didn't have our gear. Like, we have reasons. So Azaghal himself wants to fight the dragon. Like, he believes that they're going to. So the dwarf infantry that's coming in from the north is also, like, Azaghal is actually kind of hoping to kill, to fight. Mm. Because they know there's always the chance, right, that Glaurung, they're going to shoot at him. They might, like, if everything goes perfectly, Mythra steps out and says, hey, Glaurung, come kill me. He comes charging down. They shoot him full of bolts, and he drops dead in the path, and nobody gets hurt. That's perfect
optimal,
success.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's perfect success. Plan B is he probably comes and the elves have to fight with him as well, you know, or whatever. And like maybe he gets wounded, but they, you know, maybe they miss him, maybe whatever. Like, but they end up having to fight with him, and they're still trying to shoot at him with the bolts as well. And then the dwarf army comes in too. So either
and finishes him off,
and finishes him off. So they're going to come in from behind and finish him off, or maybe he turns and goes back. In which case, Azaghal is like, I'll be there, because they've got to be at. They've got to ask the question, like, what if he doesn't charge? Like, what if he does not, you know, do what we want him to do and charge? Right. And Azaghal says, then I will take him from the other side, you know, and one of us will destroy him.
Yes.
And, you know, and then, of course, like, you know, Mythros and Maglor will be like, yeah, but you don't have ballista over there. And he's like, we don't need him. We can take him. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, we are the Khazad of Belagost. Yeah.
Exactly.
Yes.
Exactly. So in that way, if we know, we wouldn't want it to look. I mean, it would be kind of cool and heroic if it sort of seems like Glaurung is falling upon unprepared dwarves who aren't ready to fight him. But then Azaghal, you know, wounds him anyway. Like, that would be cool and heroic, but it would look like worse planning on Mythros' side, right?
Yeah.
The point was to surround him and kill him. They've got three chances to kill him. They've got the ballista, they've got Mythros and the other Feanorians, and they've got the dwarves, right? And ideally all of them kind of converge
So it'll one way or another, he's not walking away from this
unwounded.
This is a very good opportunity for Barak Khazad Khazad Amenu.
Exactly. Yes. Yes. Yeah. So exactly.
I think this is good.
Yeah. Okay. Cool. Job done. All right. We can go to bed, everybody.
Excellent.
That was the Dorthonian campaign.
Yeah, I know. I'm
stage just one.
Nicely done, you guys.
That's stage one. All right. Okay. That'll do. Okay. Western Front.
Yes.
The Western Front. So out on the Western Front. So this is where we're talking about. So here we have what looks like a Karen Fonstad map of the Western Front.
I wanted a map with Angband on it.
Right.
Yes.
And I realized that there's choices made in this that we don't have to make the same choices. But
yes.
I just wanted to put Angband on the map to be like, they're looking at Angband.
Yes.
Fair enough. Yeah.
The stratospheric Thangorodrim. Yes.
Yes. Okay. So when we're talking about the Western Front, we're talking about Aethel Sirion and the Fens of Sarek. Right. Down to the Fens of Sarek.
Yeah,
right.
I think that's where we're at. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
So.
And to clarify something, with two big armies centered at those two points, Angband cannot commit an army to go out and relieve Dorthonion.
Right.
Cannot. Because essentially doing so would leave Angband wide open to attack.
And their own flanks exposed.
Right, yes. Yeah. Yeah.
Part of the idea of setting those armies up and saying, wait for the signal that tells you Dorthonion has fallen.
Yes.
Yeah.
Well, that Dorthonion has fallen and we've returned to our position in the east.
Right, and they have to wait for the Feanorians to get out of Dorthonion.
Yeah.
But there has to be some signal that the dragon is dealt with.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
That all the armies know to look for.
Yes. I mean, they can send a message for that. That's
okay.
Not a... Yeah, they're right there at that point.
Okay. Okay. Yeah, I mean, Rivel.
Yeah. So they have to... Because I imagine that this is... Like, Maedhros is not bringing out his entire army to... Because quite honestly, if it goes badly enough that he needs his entire army, it's over.
It's over. Yes.
Right. Yes. So this is kind of like a small expeditionary force of infantry. Bringing horses to this battle is probably not a great idea.
Yep. Yeah.
And so they're going to array on the eastern front out on the plains.
How far out on the plains?
Right. Right.
I've always had this problem. This has been my biggest problem visualizing the near Night and Radio.
I would say that once the Easterlings are there, they might even be kind of arraying on the at the foot of the Arid Luin. Because it's far enough out of sight from Thangorodrim that they could conceivably think that their movements aren't going to be as obvious.
So,
but that's a long way to drag your siege engine. That's
so
the
long.
Thing I'm worried about there.
So long. It's a big distance. What kind of distance are we talking about here?
That's about 150 miles.
Yeah.
We know the length of Dorthonion. That's
right.
The one measurement we have. I'm trying to recall. Is it 60 leagues or is it 60 miles?
I think we figured out it was about 150 miles, and and like looking the place that I'm talking about on Arid Luin is about that distance again from the eastern spur of the mountain surrounding Dorthonion. So that's pretty far. Although they could use Dorthonion as a staging area. They could use Lavros itself as a staging area.
But we're talking about
it.
Okay. So here's the problem I've always had
with
this passage in the book. They're attacking Angband. They're threatening against Angband by standing 100 miles away, inviting Morgoth to do what? Exactly. Like to say I'm attacking you, by keeping my army up in a fortified position 100 miles away from you. That's strange. I don't understand how that works.
Yeah.
Right? If you're on the offensive, I mean,
they have to march forward.
You have to march forward. You can't stay back in the mountain range 100 miles away.
Right. But they do have to stage their armies and get them prepared to move.
Yes.
From a safe place. Now, I'm actually starting to think that Lanzaros might be that place. Since we went through the trouble of specifically having them take it, that gives us a great kind of staging area. It's kind of sheltered. It's in the hills. But it's a straight shot from there to Angband.
Okay. All right. So
I think that Lodros is better than Ered Luin.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. No, but I'm thinking that.
Yeah.
Okay. So bigger picture.
Yeah.
Biggest picture. What is the plan?
Right.
Give me Mythros's elevator pitch.
Right. Okay. So the elevator pitch is we march our main hosts out into the field north of Lodros, right?
Yes.
Out onto the Angfala, right? That brings all eyes onto us. Presumably, Morgoth is going to be aware of Fingon staging his armies and the armies of Dor Loman on the eastern side of Ered-Wethwyn, right? Because they can't, in the book, they start out staged on the western side, but nothing happens until bring their armies over.
Yeah,
right?
Again, with the you're not threatening,
you're not attacking until you attack.
Right.
Yeah,
right,
yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
So once they're there, once they're on the eastern side of Ered-Wethwyn, Angband is going to do one of two things. Three things. They're either going to attack. They're going to come out and issue a challenge of battle. Maybe not in so many words, but they're going to. Their mere presence is a challenge to battle, or they're just going to hole up in Angband and wait. Which is not optimal. We'd rather deal with their armies in the field if we can. But that's why we have the Dwarvish Corps of Engineers. So he brings his army and the host of the Easterlings, I would say minus the chariots of Bor.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
Because they do want the plane.
Right. They want him to come out once battle is almost ready to engage. They don't want to bring him up just to throw them at the fortification. That's stupid. So they're holding him in reserve, which is good for us because it allows us to have him come in to deal with Olfang.
Right.
From the back. The
In fact, Galadriel could be with Bor.
Right.
That actually solves the whole, is Caranthir in command, is Galadriel in command, why, you know.
Yep, yep.
Separate him into two groups.
Yeah, the Bor and Olfang problem.
Right,
Oldor
yes.
issue, yeah.
And so Oldor is supposed to be marching with him.
Yes.
The Dwarvish Corps of Engineers only comes out if, you know, when the armies on the field have been dealt with.
Okay. Hang on. But I still need to back up a step.
Right.
Because here's the step that I'm having a problem with. So, again, this is me, role-playing Orodreth or something at the summit meeting. Right.
Right. Yes.
And being like, okay, so why? Obviously, if we can draw the armies of Angband out onto Enfalgwith and attack them from multiple directions.
Yes.
We stand a pretty good chance of stomping them.
Yes.
Sure.
Especially if we've taken out the dragon first.
Right.
That's a good plan. But it's premised upon the armies of Angband coming out into the field. Why did they do that?
They do that because Morgoth believes that he that he can defeat them, right? But you can't count on that happening because it seems That's like a monumentally stupid thing to do.
As a plan.
So here's, right. So we know that Morgoth is going to bait Fingon's army by saying, hey, I got your prisoners. Let me execute them in front of you. Is there something that the other side can be doing to bait Morgoth's army?
Exactly. Because so the counter...
They don't have to actually ever do it because they weren't ready. Exactly. It could be part of the plan at the council how will you get Morgoth out? Because his army's out.
Yeah. This has always seemed like a weakness of the whole plan. Because, Morgoth's counter is going to be... So Morgoth knows they're going to try to take his army on the field in a pincer movement. So, but he can counter that, and he doesn't want to lose the opportunity to destroy all the elves on the field. Like, that'll be great, but he wants to win. So if I can delay the one half of the pincer, draw the other one out and destroy them on the field by themselves and then turn and destroy the other one, then great. Like, problem solved.
So
that's a sensible counter, but it still doesn't answer the first question as to why does Maedhros think he's going to come out in the first place? The smart thing for him to do is just stay home.
So Maedhros, when Fingon and Húrin establish a foothold on Ungfaleth, they are taking back territory, right, that had been in Morgoth's hands.
Right.
Just so by doing that.
The solution here is you plant a lot of flags.
Okay.
Yeah, right, which they in fact do, right?
Because the more flags you put up, the more you're reclaiming the territory, saying you got to come out to stop us from doing this, and our flags are getting closer.
And Maedhros is not supposed to come out onto Ungfaleth until Morgoth commits a non-zero amount of his forces.
So that they can do the pincher,
Right. Now, his plan can include a contingency for that doesn't happen. Mm-hmm. That doesn't happen. We resume the siege right on top of Thangorodrim. The Dwarvish Corps of Engineers comes up. They blast through the gates. We go down there and we fight our way all the way down to the bottom.
And drag him out of his hole. And
You know, as we've always dreamed of doing, right? Mm-hmm. But that is definitely like the contingency of contingencies, right? That's not our but we are prepared to do that, which is why we have siege weapons with us.
Who would go into a battle without siege weapons?
So okay, I know you guys don't like what Tolkien did there, but I will point out that when he has armies use siege weapons, it's always the bad guys, right? Like Morgoth obviously has siege equipment when he attacks Gondolin in the Fall of Gondolin. Sauron has plenty of it at Minas Tirith in the Battle of Pelennor Fields. Like, it's not that the guy doesn't know what siege equipment is for.
Right, right.
It's that he thinks that only really bad people use it, apparently.
Right, because like, it's mechanical.
Well, or just it's for
invading.
Starving people out and destroying cities and being a bad guy.
It's like, about destroying things,
Yeah, right. Who uses siege equipment to be a good guy?
Right.
So from that point of view,
people who want to destroy, want to destroy fortified positions of bad guys. That's who.
I understand all this,
but so hang on. So
it's probably important that we don't have elves invent siege equipment or use siege equipment directly in the story, because that seemed to be important to Tolkien on some level.
I get it.
So if the dwarves do it, it's fine because the dwarves are morally ambiguous
in a
way.
It's a good solution. Okay, so hang on though. Speaking of not coming to a siege with siege equipment, Aragorn, Black Gate, no plan for how to get into Black Gate, right? None at all.
That was kind of the point.
Exactly, but that's it, right? That's a plan. His whole plan was we're going to go up there because we know. Right,
and the cat will take them out.
He
will take the stinger. Yeah, whatever.
The fact that we're standing there is going to be enough to draw him out.
Yeah, and ultimately he can say, okay, worst case scenario, Morgoth does not take the field. We march right up to the gate, and we pull a Fingolfin.
Yeah,
and we challenge him.
Yeah,
you know, let the Lord of the Black Land come forth, and so on and so forth.
Yeah.
And if he doesn't come out, We have
we'll take the door down.
Right.
Yeah.
Like, if he doesn't open the door, we'll knock it down for him. So, again, as long as there are contingencies in place,
but
then we're
fine. But it seems to me that that has to be plan A. Like, who, when, where is let the Lord of the Dark Land come forth? Like, did we just not get to that stage in the plan before the battle on the Western Front begins because Morgoth anticipates it? Or, I mean, like, because we've got Fingon in the west, far in the west, five days march in the west, and then you've got Mithras in the east, right? Also really far in the east. Who's drawing them out into the field in the first place? And be like, hang on, stay there. Not only come out of the gates, come out of the gates onto the field and please remain there for a week so that we can get there in order to do our pincher movement thing, right?
Yeah, we do have a timing issue because it's true that I've always thought of Gwynder's charge as kind of like Pickett's charge at Gettysburg.
Yeah.
Where, you know, this is going to end badly for you, but it was the, you know, high water mark of the Confederacy. They did get to the line and all that. That was
they
a mile.
They did take the wall.
Exactly. And that's the thing. And Gwyndor got to the gate and got inside the gate.
Yeah, exactly.
But everybody who went over the wall was either killed or captured. Yes. Everybody who gets through the gate of Angband is, it has a similar feel to the outcome.
Yes.
That was a 1 mile charge.
Yes.
Into cannon fire. So, I mean, cannon fire is maybe slightly different than this. But still, I don't think we can have them march 5 days and have the same feel. So they do have to probably be a lot closer, which we can fudge the distances of where Angband is because it's not on the map.
Right. So,
the
initial plan seems to have been that Mithros would, that Fingon and Hurin would take these defensive positions.
Yeah.
And that Mithros would come out onto the field, make a big show of coming out onto the field with this huge army to issue the challenge.
So Mithros is going to be the one crying out, let the Lord of the Black Land come forth.
Right, right.
And then Fingon was supposed to do the pincher move. So that's part of why Fingon's position is supposed to wait.
Right.
Like, they're not supposed to be. Because otherwise it feels like if the whole point was Morgoth's army comes out and then we fight him, what's wrong with Fingon's army charging early? Like,
right.
Wasn't that the plan?
Yes.
So it has to very deliberately not be the plan.
If I'm Mithros, I put all of my core guys on the right-hand side of that line, and all of Uldor's men are going to be on the left side of that line. So when I receive the charge of Morgoth, my line opens like a door, right? So my auxiliary forces fall back before them, which allows Fingon to now come in from the other side.
Right. So now we're that we got him right between.
Right.
Okay. So I have a thought, and I'm thinking about the flexibility of the plan. Right.
Right.
Okay. Plan A, prior to the Easterlings, right?
Mm-hmm.
Prior to the Easterlings, plan A is Mithros and the Fëanor. I think Mithros always plans to make himself the bait.
Yes.
I was about to say, it seems to be what he did with the dragon. I think he's going to do the same thing with Morgoth.
Exactly.
He's just like, come fight me.
Yeah,
right.
This is Mithros' big moment, right?
Yes.
So Mithros' plan is that he and the Fëanorian army is going to be the... So when there are no Easterlings in the equation, it can still work if, Nick, as you say, like he pivots so that when they charge out, he takes them around the side, and then Fingon comes in from the other side. And now, like, we can add, if we can add Nargothrond and Doriath coming up from the south from Dorthonion, which is now de-dragoned, right? Then now we get them on three sides, right?
Right.
But if we don't have, because
it would have been proper awesome if the forces of Nargothrond and Doriath were hiding in the hills of Dorthonion and appeared out on the battlefield unlooked for, right in the middle of it,
from three directions, right?
Yeah.
That's plan A. Now, we can do, if we have to do it only from the two sides, fine. We can still do, like, still the core plan will still work of the Fëanorians challenging battle and then Fingon and the men of Hithlum coming in from the other side, right? Yes. Then when we're still taking them, and we still believe we can take them between the two of us. Oh, and by the way, I've got Dwarvish Engineer, so we can get into Angband also, no problems, right?
Yeah.
But now the Easterlings come in, right? So now Mothero says, okay, now better plan, right? Instead of doing the pivot thing, right, mm-hmm. where we're take, because we don't have two sides, we have three fronts. We're
right
back to the plan. Right.
Mm-hmm.
Except we don't put them in Dorthonian. What happens is now instead of them standing there to challenge and then pivoting them around so they can get them in between, now they withdraw and draw them out and out and out onto the field. And then Fingon comes in from the one side and the Easterlings charge in from the other side.
And the reason that this can work is because Uldor's men are a well-trained professional army. They're like the Feanorians. That's one of the reasons why Mythros likes this guy, because yes. they're like, these are the first professional soldiers that they've had to fight alongside them.
And they're very numerous.
In the whole time.
Yeah.
Right. And there's tons of them.
There's
right?
tons of them.
And Uldor is not above, I don't want to say throwing his men's lives away.
Sure.
But he's willing.
He's not overcautious. Sure. Yeah.
He's Grant.
Yeah. Well, let's not go that far. but anyway, yeah. He's
war winner.
All
I'm saying.
I hear you. Okay, so, but you see, this also solves two other problems, right? It solves the heck out of the delay problem, because now Uldor's needs to delay himself, right?
Right.
His coordination with Mythros is still being delayed, right? But he doesn't have to like hold back Mythros himself. He just has to hold back his own men. But secondly, it also makes for an extremely shocking and climactic betrayal. Mm. When the army of the Easterling charges in from the east just as planned, but plows into Mythros' army instead of plowing into Morgoth's army.
Mm.
And everything goes horribly awry at that
yeah.
moment. Like, again, we can definitely have that, but the day might still have been won kind of moment right there. Right.
Yeah.
It will be the opposite of the black ships situation.
Right.
When the black ships come up the Anduin, it's like, oh no, the Corsairs of Umbar are here, and that's really bad news for us.
Yeah.
But surprise, it was Aragorn all along.
Right. In this case, but surprise, so, they're actually bad guys all along.
Yeah. Right. So, it was the, here comes the
right.
army to save the day and help, and suddenly they attack you.
Right. So the way that this happens, it's not so Ulfang. So the murder happens, right?
Yes.
Right. Ulfang's already dead.
Ulfang's dead.
Right. Right. Yeah. Oh, I keep mixing up Uldor and Ulfang. That's right.
Yeah, yeah.
Right. Ulfang's the dad. Uldor's right. the son. And yes. Uldor has two younger brothers, so if we need more characters.
Right. Yeah, definitely what the season needs is more characters. Uldor kills his father. The delay is actually, it actually seems quite natural, because now there's political chaos in the camp. Like, so Uldor's excuse for not marching is, I have to get a handle on the situation.
Yes.
I don't know what you want me to do.
Our general has just been murdered. Yeah. Like,
right.
We're in chaos.
You know, and, you know, you guys are super sus anyway.
Right.
By the way, and so eventually Mythros, who keeps looking out on the field, realizes it's time. I gotta go. There's too much going on there. Get a handle on it or don't. I'm marching off to war. I'm taking my sons of Amlok with me, who my steadfast human followers who are never gonna betray me.
Yes.
And we're gonna go. Bor and Galadriel
are also ready to go.
But their whole role is to sweep out to the right so that they can catch them from behind.
They loop around behind. Yes, exactly.
Right.
Because they're the cavalry. Yeah.
Right. Yes. Yes. Yeah. Because I think that at this point, the Kelgorm's cavalry is really kind of decimated by now.
And would have presumably played a very significant role in the drawing out of the
right.
army from Angband.
But he lost a lot of them in Nargothrond.
In Nargothrond, yeah. Yeah.
So now when when the Feanorians get betrayed, then Bor and Galadriel can now instead turn and hit them
from behind,
because it becomes clear to Bor, yes, Bor that this was Uldor's plan all along.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Right. Yes.
Exactly. And Bor and Galadriel charging down can then be in turn what enables like the Feanorians to escape. And,
right.
Yeah.
Right. Right. Yes.
Yeah, because the Feanorians all get wounded, but none of them get killed in this battle.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. So the fact that they have a giant army attacking them that they thought was their ally, you would expect more casualties on the Eastern Front.
I mean, there
get.
Are probably plenty of casualties, just not those six
right,
people.
Not the name characters.
Right, right. No, exactly. But it's still, there's still, I mean, the fact
considering
that they all
survived. Mithras' whole plan seems to be, so I put myself out front and taunt the bad guys.
Yes.
And he walks away from this
right.
battle.
Yes. Right.
Yes. Like,
right.
And in fact, isn't the one who gets up to the gates of Bang Band at all.
Right.
No. Yeah.
So, okay.
But, I mean, he is going to be wounded, of course. So.
But I think that Uldor's people will destroy the siege engines. I think that for them, that's step one.
Okay. Yeah. Sure. Because then they can know for sure that
There is no way into Angband.
There is no way. Yeah. Okay. So there's still the one step that I'm not getting. And that is it's the Western Front is still what's causing me trouble.
Right.
So the plan, like, again, all respect to the text, the plan cannot be that Fingon and Húrin are going to stay 150 miles away.
No.
And then come charging across 150 miles in order to attack them from the side.
Yes.
The plan
it's
has
very
to have
clear.
Been
yes.
that Mithras and his people, they're going to march right up in front of the gate.
Yes.
Let the Lord of the Black Clan come forth, and then they're going to either withdraw and pivot, or in the new plan, they're going to just withdraw straight back. But it means that Fingon and his people have to be there. They have to be in range. They have to be within a few miles in order to attack them.
Yeah.
But it has to be, there has to have been stealth planned, because why would they,
so
come charging
we,
out?
We do know that the Balrogs put a lot of tunnels in Anfalglith in the lead up to the taking of Tol Sirion.
Right.
Mm.
So there are stealthy ways to move around that very open plain.
Just like
not,
in the Hobbit movies. Yes. Sorry.
I mean,
I'm teasing
maybe not
you.
Just
I, that was
like
mean.
That.
But no, but you're but yes, we did that already.
But
we
do
that.
Have those tunnels.
We do have
so
tunnels.
If we need some stealth.
And we're not bringing in sandworms, so it's totally fine. Like it's good. Legitimate.
But anyway.
Yeah.
And those tunnels terminate at Tol Sirion. Not Tol Sirion. At the Fens
of
at
Sarek,
the earthworks of the Fens of Sarek. Yeah.
Right. So if we were staging the army at the Fens of Sarek, they can use those tunnels to get a lot closer to Angband before they pop up.
Okay.
Right.
So,
Of course, the tunnels are probably like full of orcs.
Yeah.
Or at least orc patrolled or something.
Yeah. I mean, like, I don't think those tunnels were abandoned at any point. So using them is a little risky. But that sounds like a job for Rogren.
Well,
go in these tunnels and mess everything up.
Right. Because you also, I mean, using those tunnels is very much not without. So there are two. A couple downsides to using the tunnels, right? Mm-hmm. One downside is that you're bottling up your army.
Yes.
I don't think you want to send the whole army through the tunnels.
No.
Secondly, it's not, on the one hand, it's stealthy because you can't be seen. But on the other hand, it's not stealthy because if the tunnels are full of the enemy who are going to go running back reporting that you're in there, then it doesn't help.
Well, also, like, there's so many things that can go wrong there. Like, the tunnels aren't necessarily a straight shot.
Right.
There might be all kinds of twists and turns in the cul-de-sacs, and you don't necessarily know that you're going to go the right way.
You don't have a map.
These guys are not going to be proficient at navigating underground.
Right.
Right. In addition, I would actually kind of prefer that they don't even know about the tunnels, because it's a huge wrinkle if they do. Because, like, if
the
enemy finds out about
it. Them.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and in fact, I think that that's
better than Dun Raymond.
That's how they get
opinion.
Ambushed at the Fens.
Exactly.
At the end, when they think they've gotten away, and they have in fact not.
Yes. Yes. Man, can I just
It makes more sense for those tunnels to be used by Morgoth's army. I agree. Yeah. I just was mentioning that we have them.
Yeah, no, so...
We introduced them at the very beginning of the last season. So they're fairly new. There's
ways to handle this. So the men of Hithlum are actually horse archers, we've established. Mm-hmm. Or like cavalry, at the very least.
Yes.
So they can... It wouldn't take them that long to cross the plain.
Right.
And Fingon also has cavalry. So they could conceivably have thought, okay, Maedhros draws out the army, and he backs away from them for several days while the cavalry crosses Angfalath. So that can have been the plan. As far as that's concerned.
And the fact is, to some extent, it doesn't matter. So, like, the worst case scenario, right? The worst case scenario is that Morgoth comes out onto the field and attacks Fingon first.
Mm-hmm.
But then Maedhros takes him
from the bind. Yeah.
So, like, not a huge deal. Yeah. Yeah.
Right, the part where it's like, oh no, Gwyndor messed up everything by charging early. Only if Uldor also betrays them. Like, right. Gwyndor's mistake is just a mistake. It was a recoverable mistake.
It was a very, yes, exactly.
Like, it wasn't the plan. You're not supposed to do this, Gwyndor.
Clearly, and how we can show that is, so, these are long distances that we're traveling, right?
Yeah.
So we've got, like, days to weeks in which we're setting up the final, putting everybody in position for the final battle. We've just done the dragon. Maedhros is in Dorthonion. He's just done the dragon, right?
Mm-hmm.
So Maedhros is in Dorthonion, which is great because he's going to come up from the south anyway, straight up to the gates. And
so he's staging his army there in Lothbros.
In Dorthonion. Yeah, exactly. Yes. So he comes to Dorthonion. But even from the edge of Dorthonion up to Angband is still...
It's about 30 miles.
30 miles, right? Okay. Yeah. So,
well, based on this map, I think this map is wrong. I'm going to say it's probably about 70 miles.
Okay. So, as a reminder,
what we have shown in film is Glaurung issuing from the gates of Angband and crossing over to Dorthonion at the beginning of the Dagor Bragollach.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And that happened within an amount of time. We did not, like, real time, take a camera and watch
because it was going to, it would have been terrible.
That would have been very silly. Right. So we see him issue out and we see him arrive in the next episode. Like, I think we cut the episode.
Even if it's 50 miles, right? But you got to figure Glaurung can be doing 40 and get there in an hour and 15 minutes, right?
That was the idea, is that the amount of time that passed from, oh, look, there seems to be a fire over there, to, oh, no, there's a dragon at our wall.
Yeah.
Is like an hour.
At most an hour.
Yeah, exactly.
So it was within a very short amount of time. So,
so he didn't catch them all in their beds, but still it's sudden. Yeah. Yes. Okay. Anyway, but the point is the Elvish army is going to be less sudden. But anyway, so Maedhros is there in Dorthonion. Step one of the plan is Maedhros comes out. Right. Maedhros comes out. So if the army, so the Western army is marching across to get into their position and they can be covered by the cavalry, by Húrin's cavalry. Right, and they're gonna establish some kind. They're gonna like dig in or something on Enfalgrim.
Right. So here's what we do. Rather than have them stage at the foot of Barad Ethel, they're staged. I don't know if you remember the defensive position that Fingolfin took in our version of the Dagor Bragollach, where like there were ripples in the the cooled magma.
Yeah.
That's where Fingon goes.
Yes.
To stage his armies.
Yes.
Right? What's his face? Húrin is still starting at the Fens of Sarek because he doesn't have a lot of infantry that he's got to march up. So he's just got to book it as soon as the armies of Angband come out of the gate.
And can I say, by the way, it makes the sacrifice of the men of Dor Lomond so much cooler if they're the light cavalry of this whole thing.
Yeah.
Because they're light cavalry. Like, they have their horses still. Like, they could get away.
They can leave.
They could get away. They easily could have gotten away, but instead, they're like, if we get away, then Turgon's getting chased all the way back to Gondolin.
Right.
And we're going to dismount from our horses, let our horses go, and deliberately stage this infantry retreat. That makes it more
so the horses of Dorlumen survived the battle. They survived the Gondolin. Battle.
Exactly.
So we will spare the horses.
We'll spare the
horses.
Not
the men. They all die to a man. But we're going to spare the horses.
Lord of the Rings style instead of Hobbit style. Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
But Húrin could be holding his men back like during the charge of the Noldor,
mm-hmm.
right? And even so that he, like his men pop up unlooked for, in fact, because we'll have forgotten about them, right? Because they haven't engaged in the action up until.
Okay, so anyway, so you gotta
Wait. Did you just say that Húrin, who has spent this entire season going, what I really want to do more than anything
wisely,
is fight Morgoth,
yes.
is he just sits the battle out and watches
No. He engages in the battle. I'm just saying that the initial charge, rash charge, he's not part of.
Because he's not in the infantry.
Which is fine. Okay. I was just making sure we didn't have Húrin do something wildly out of character.
No. I'm not saying he sits the whole battle out. No, that's
you guys go fight. I've got some.
No. He goes out onto the field for sure. Yeah.
Okay. All right. So they're coming from. So their plan is to form up in those.
There's a geographical term for that. I just don't remember what it is.
Exactly right. So they're gonna take up their positions there, and then. Once they're there, then Maedhros marches out, right? Maedhros marches out and challenges him, and the armies come out. And then the Easterlings come in from the east. But they're supposed to be in position too, right? Mm. They're supposed to be in position also. And then, okay, anyway, so that's the plan. Now, again, the question still is, so why would Morgoth go into this trap? Why would he send out his armies into the trap? And the answer is... because he's being dared to.
Right.
I was about to say, Maedhros' entire strategy seems to be, I bet you the enemy really wants to kill me.
Yes.
How much do you bet, you guys, that if I go out here there and be like, hey, right. remember me? Oh, sorry. Remember me, the one who got away.
Exactly.
He can even be prepared to like hold his stump up in the air.
Exactly,
yeah.
right.
Yeah.
yeah.
That's his understanding of Morgoth's personality is that if he stands there and taunts him, Morgoth will trap him. Aragorn's plan too was Sauron's going to want to get me because he thinks I have the ring.
Yes.
So he's going to come after me and he knows I'm Isildur's heir. He's mad at me. Like if it's anybody else, Aragorn's plan in front of the Black Gate doesn't work and looks dumb.
Yeah.
But he knows Sauron wants him.
Yes.
So Maedhros seems to be of the same opinion that, you know what? I think Morgoth really, really would like to kill me.
Yes, but ultimately,
if
he doesn't, they're still prepared for that scenario.
Yes, mm-hmm. yes,
they do have a backup plan.
Yeah, the worst case scenario is then they blow down the doors and mm-hmm. and fight their way in.
Yeah, and the idea being that Baron and Luthien went all the way through Angband, got to the court at the bottom. It can't be that hard, you guys. Once we're through the gate, like sure, we can fight the entire army of Angband underground on their
send the dwarves in first.
I was trying to decide whom such a fight would actually favor. Because on the one hand, you could put some Balrogs at choke points, and it would be a little tough, right? Mm-hmm. But
eventually, they would cave to numbers for sure.
You'd think, right? Yeah. I mean, I don't know because the disparity between Caliquendi and orcs in the field. I mean, you know, a group of 50 Caliquendi in a hallway with a whole bunch of orcs. Like, how many orcs is going to take to, you know? Anyway, I think their odds would be reasonable, actually, if they did get in through the gates.
There's also a home field advantage. There's probably defensive structures all the way down. Like, it's...
I know.
But there's really a reason messy.
It didn't work out for Gwyndor.
Right. And there's a reason that was not plan A.
I mean, he was banging on doors with his fists. I mean, that was not going to go well.
Yeah, yeah. But anyhow,
in the kill box.
Right, right, exactly. Okay.
Oh, by the way, the word for the structure that we're talking about is Igneous flow structures.
Igneous flow structures. Sure.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
All you could also call them flow banding, lava pillows, or lava levees.
Ah, lava pillows is my lava familiar pillows. With. Yeah.
Yeah.
That sounds like a great term to use when you're discussing a military campaign.
Yeah, the lava pillows. It's extremely aggressive terminology. Yes. Right there.
Very martial.
Yeah, very martial. Okay, so that was the plan. Now, Morgoth's plan.
Mm-hmm.
Morgoth's plan is, he says, I'm not going to wait for them to finish forming their kill box for me to step into.
Yes. Right.
That feels dumb.
Like, I am going to fight them because this is a delicious opportunity they've provided. And yes. I also know I've got some aces in the hole that they don't know about. Right.
Right.
But the first thing I want to do is I want to attack them while they're still separate.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. Disrupt the plan for
He disrupts the plan. So Gwyndor's charge happens after Fingon is in place. In his forward position, but before Mithros gets up there.
Right.
So Mithros isn't yet on the field. So there's going to be, for however long it's going to take Mithros and the Feanorians to get there from Dorthonion, is how long Fingon's army has to fight the whole army of Angband by itself, thanks to Gwyndor.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
And it still could win. It still could work, especially because Gwyndor's charge is way more successful than, you know, Morgoth.
Than anyone could have hoped, yeah.
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 The other thing we can do is, if we want to preserve some of the descriptions, is we don't have to have Anfalglith go all the way up to the gate, right? Mm-hmm. So there we can show that the armies from Angband can't see all of Fingon's people. Like, we can still preserve that a little bit. They're just hiding behind rocks instead of trees, but like, they can be somewhat
concealed. That was the idea.
With the lava. Yeah, yeah. But my point is that we can preserve that description of the silent waiting hills.
Yes.
But it's just it's not trees.
Yes. Well, so what I was thinking is that he gets out onto the flow structures, and his forces there are like steadily growing. They're like funneling people out of the causeway, so they're forming up there, but there's still people marching up, right? Mm-hmm. And in fact, well, I guess he has to be there because he's gotta give the line when he sees Turgon appear.
Yes.
Yeah, so I'll come back to Turgon in a second, but okay, yes. Yeah, so Morgoth's plan, just as Mithros' plan is premised on the fact that he believes Morgoth wants to kill him enough that he's going to come out to do it. Morgoth's plan is that even if he engages with and smashes Fingon before Mithros gets there, Mithros is still going to attack.
Right.
Like, if he sees them out on the field, even if the plan has already gone disastrously awry, Mithros is still going to attack, especially since Morgoth knows that Mithros thinks that he's still got the Easterling support coming in.
Right.
Right. So yes, if he can then engage Mithros' charge, and then Morgoth knows. So Morgoth's strategy is relatively simple. Engage Fingon first, get Fingon out of his defenses ideally, but in any case, engage Fingon first. Ideally, break the back of Fingon's army before Mithros can get there. So he's fighting the two of them separately and having the Easterlings come in. Morgoth has got a great counter plan. Like, that's a really solid, especially with the betrayal of Uldor, that's a really solid counter plan.
Yeah. Now, question, how much does Morgoth know about the Easterlings, and how does he know it?
Well, now, he Sauron could just know knows.
About his, right, yeah. But
so we talked about this a little bit. We didn't want to do a scene where Sauron gets back to Angband and reports and be like, hey, boss, you know, we don't want to do that scene. But we think that we kind of have to sort of imply that something like that happens, essentially. That
we need a scene with Sauron after the battle where Sauron takes credit for his role.
Yep. Yeah.
And that should more or less answer the question is, how did Morgoth know that was going to happen?
Okay.
It was orchestrated by Sauron, so of course Morgoth knew.
Yeah, yeah.
Like, Sauron doesn't have a secret from Morgoth at this point.
And
even if he was operating
independently. Well, especially if Sauron shows up at some point and meets with Uldor in Beleriand.
Yes.
Then,
So one suggestion was we were going to have two meetings with Sauron the Easterlings. The first one would take place in Bree land.
Yeah,
right.
And a suggestion that was made after the broadcast was, what if instead of meeting with Uldor, that meeting is with All Fang? And All Fang is the one who... Uldor's there.
Could be there.
But the character that Sauron is meeting with is All Fang.
Is All Fang,
right.
Yeah.
And the conversation is between the two of them. And All Fang more or less rejects whatever Sauron's offering.
Right, he's not into it. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
So,
but Uldor knows it's on the table.
Right. So then in Beleriand, Sauron comes to Uldor and has a conversation where it's like, remember all that.
Right.
Yeah.
Are you in?
Right. And so he... So, okay. So we can actually... It would be interesting if we maintained the idea that the potent taint of Bree is setting Ulfang up, setting Uldor up through Ulfang, that Sauron then comes to Ulfang with Uldor there, tells him about how the potentate does not have your best interests at heart. You need to align with us. It's going to be great. You know, Morgoth will reward his, you know, his, those who serve him. And meanwhile, while he is speaking to Ulfang, he is talking, while he's speaking to Uldor, he's talking to Ulfang. And the person who does not have his best interest at heart is actually his father.
Yeah.
Right.
Yes. In fact, it's exactly like The Godfather when Sonny betrays the fact that he's interested in Salieri's offer, right?
Yes.
Yeah. Yes. It's exactly like that.
Yeah.
It took me a second. I was like, wait, this is reminding me of something. That's what it's reminding me of.
There's no cultural touchstone for me in any of that.
Yes. Right. No, but that's that. Yeah. I like that. I like that a lot. And because again, one of the things that I like, we don't have to be clumsy with the deals and the explanations and everything like that. Right.
All of these people are really smart people who are being very manipulative and very canny and clever in their dealings.
Yes.
Like everything Sauron does extra things.
Yes.
So that if the primary thing doesn't work out, there's a secondary thing on deck ready to go.
And nobody has to actually get duped, like just completely suckered, except Caranthir.
Right. Yeah. And maybe a little bit Ulfang.
But that's because it's his son. Right. So
Uldor is a very smart guy.
Yes.
One question is about the ages. Tolkien had Ulfang and Bor both quite old.
Yes.
So that their sons were like in their 40s or so. Do we want Ulfang to be a guy in his 60s or 70s? Or do we want him significantly younger?
Ulfang, 70s would be a little hard to believe.
Yeah, I would say 50s and 60s.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay, so the father 50s, 60s, so the son is going to be younger in our version.
Yeah, I would say it would be easier and certainly more believable if he's younger. The younger he is, the more believable it is. But he doesn't have to be super young.
Right. Well, that's what I'm saying. If his dad's in his 50s,
right?
He's not necessarily 20.
And his
20.
Dad is super hale. Like it looks like his dad could live another 30, 40 years, no problem.
Yeah.
Which is why the assassination makes more sense. If his dad was already elderly.
Yeah. No, like, it would.
Okay. So we're going to age them down a bit.
Age them down. And can I just say in passing, Tolkien had a weird thing about geriatric battle leaders.
Yeah.
Like,
yes.
And I don't just mean the seriously geriatric like Theoden.
Theoden,
I mean, like,
yes.
even like Theodred and Amir are like weirdly old.
Yes.
Like older than it seems like they should be. Yeah, they're almost 40. Like unmarried 40-year-old heirs. But even apart from the ridiculousness of the unmarriedness at that point, Boromir too, like they're all old. Like he doesn't do the like young, you know, 20-something warrior thing. Like,
what year was he born again?
Tolkien?
Yeah.
1892?
1892. Okay, well, that makes sense because he was like in his 40s and 50s.
Oh, yeah.
When he was writing this. Was
absolutely, yeah. Exactly, yeah.
He's like, yeah, I could totally be doing this now. Sure.
Right.
Me,
right, yeah.
With my academic life that I've lived ever since I exactly. went to war and immediately was ill.
But it's so strange because, of course, like, that's not how the Anglo-Saxons rolled. Like,
no.
With
no.
50-year-old war leaders.
Well, I mean...
On some level, we have to admit that he was kind of writing a little bit of escapist fantasy for his own self.
For his own self, yeah. Mm-hmm.
And he was also giving longer lifespans to some of his characters.
People, yeah. That's why I'm not even counting
that Aragorn is out there doing this at 87.
Yeah,
is
no,
not
no,
a big
no.
deal.
That's obviously a bad data point, right? But
yes. Sure. Yeah. But...
But
in
Dunedain years, he's still about my age.
Right.
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 So I am fine with
aging these guys down
because
we
have no context for them.
Yeah.
It's not like we met them when they were younger and they've now grown up. Yeah.
And quite honestly, if we hand a casting director all this information, they're still going to age these actors still going to appear to be at least 10 years younger than we imagine them.
Probably, yeah. Yeah.
So, okay. So just so long as I was trying to get a handle on that betrayal father-son relationship dynamic there.
Yeah.
Okay. I think it's good for them both to be a little bit younger there. But anyway, yeah, no, this is, I'm feeling better about the plans. And I think this is a good plan. The weakness of the plan, I mean, as a plan, I'm not thinking about the actual battle. I'm thinking about the plan, right? Like what we're selling at the summit. Right. And, the weak point of the plan is still, okay, but what if he doesn't come out? What if he just stays behind the gates? And,
right. But if we've already got the Corps of Engineers secured by that point.
Right. So if he can say that he's confident they can get through the gate, that they can break the gate.
Yeah.
Yes.
Then it feels less hopeless.
How many gates are there? Just the one?
I mean,
if I'm designing that fortress, there's way more than that.
There have to be more.
There's one at each. There's at least one on each level, right? All the way down. There's got to be a defensible point.
Well, and I got to think because like
and actual doors to let the army pour out.
Yeah,
not,
exactly.
They're not only exiting through that main gate. There's the whole idea is that you can come up from the ground.
Even if you can do 10 at a time out of the gate. It's going to take a whole long time for a big army to come out of that gate if that's the only way they can come. So anyway, the reason I'm asking is if they know this, if they've scouted this, then the Dwarven Engineers don't just have to take down the main gate. They can open up 10 different entrances in.
Right.
And their Rogren armies together are to enough to get. Yeah. No, I mean, now it still seems to me like a weak point. Like I said, I'm not sure they might not have a pretty good chance if, you know, in the underground
if
fighting.
They go down, yeah.
But still, like, if I'm selling this to my potential allies, that's still, the odds of that still feel a little shaky, right? But still.
What, like, at this point, what are their options? Right. Like, the other option is a lot of Sindar get murdered, right? Like, so Fingon can even bring up this exact point. Like, what if he doesn't come out and we've got to fight him all the way down to the basement? And that's when Maedhros is going to say, look, we have to do this.
Well, and not only that, though, but like also like, well, that the advantage then or the, you know, the draw for that is then we get a chance to go in and cleanse Thangorodrim. Down to the we get to go and set all the prisoners free. We get to go in and the whole danger has been like Angband has been this wall, right? We've never been. We believe we can get in there more than one way. Is it going to be a fight inside? Yeah, but we'll have all of the armies bottled up where we can come at them from multiple different ways, and we'll be able to set the prisoners free. We'll be able to like, doesn't that sound attractive? They don't know that. Celebrimbor's mom's dead, do they?
Right.
No,
I was about
no
to
idea.
Say, Daryl died last season,
but nobody knows that.
Right.
And, well, the question is, does Curriffin just know that his wife is dead?
No, he might.
Yeah.
Well,
he might be kind of closed off to the Force in a way, though.
I think that what happens in Angband is secret and cut and a mystery.
Like, also, I think that he has put her out of his mind. Like, she's not accessible to him.
Yeah.
And so he has, in order to deal with that, because I believe on some level he cares about her, right? They got married, for goodness sake. So he has kind of compartmentalized everything that when he thinks everything about her into like this deep recess of his mind, because what good is it to think about her?
Yeah.
It certainly doesn't improve his position or get him any closer to his goals. And it doesn't help her either.
Right. And he's a pretty calculating guy to begin with. But of course, it's more than just Duriel, right? The point is there will be a bunch of prisoners, many people. In fact, Gwyndor's at the summit, isn't he? Like, we will fight our way into the dungeons and set free the prisoners. Like, you've got Gwyndor's vote now, right? Yeah. Like, he's going to be into that angle for sure.
Yeah.
So, and in fact, that's what's going to be in his mind. Like, hey, like, that's it. We're going. Like, I was promised we would get the chance to go underground. Well, I'm going straight underground. This is the plan, right?
Right.
And he's almost living the dream right there.
Almost.
Except the end result of the dream has kind of taken a turn.
It backfires. Yeah. No question.
Right. But he gets to experience what it's like to be a prisoner of Angband rather than rescue the prisoners of Angband.
But still, anyway, the point is, there are certain attractions to that angle. The let's fight underground angle, right? Because, I mean, if I'm Mythros and I'm writing the speech, right? And somebody says, what happens if he doesn't come in? Then you say, then we break down the gates and we go in after him and he's already lost. Because his only hope is in overwhelming numbers. And he can't bring overwhelming numbers to bear in tunnels under the ground. We will be able to fight through. We will be able to set our prisoners free.
It sounds good. So
it'll work.
It works.
I think it works. Yeah. Again, it's admittedly the weakest element, right? Mm-hmm. I think of the plan, but I think it'll
in the conversations,
roll.
It was the weakest point of the plan in the book too. So
yeah, well, because there was no siege equipment at all.
Exactly, it was a pretty weak plan.
I think in his conversations with Fingon in private before the summit, he can make it very clear that Morgoth's not going to ignore this challenge.
Yeah. Yeah. I am pretty confident he's going to come out.
Right. Yes. So he knows that the actual fight's going to be on Unfalglas because an army is going to come face them.
Yeah.
Just because he knows Morgoth.
Yes. Because there are names among us that are worth 1,000 mailed knights apiece. Yes. Mm. Yes. Yes. Exactly. Okay. I like it.
Yeah.
And I think especially that one of the things that's particularly lovely about this, it fits the qualifications of the sort of flexible plan that can adapt to all the different vicissitudes of the planning stages. Right.
Right.
Mm-hmm. It's a better plan with Gondolin and Doriath with them, but it still works without them. And then even the Easterling Nargothrond comes in like a Eucatastrophe. You know, the Easterlings come in like a Eucatastrophe, and this is now looking like an amazing, rock-solid plan, right? Now, Turgon. The Gondolindrim come in. How do they, like... So they come in, they would naturally, even not knowing the plan and having no communication...
They would come up alongside the Fens of Sarek.
They'd come up alongside the Fens of... They'd come out the Fens of Sarek, right? And then they'd be marching up at an angle, and they would encounter Fingon's army in the... Like, Fingon's army wouldn't be hiding from the back, right? So they would see them and find them. They would have brought some horses with them into Gondolin. They would have some scouts and cavalry, wouldn't they? Some, not like, not,
yeah,
you know,
they have horses in Gondolin.
Caligorm style, but yeah. They would have enough so that they could, I mean, just to make it realistic that they would be able to assess what's going on Unfalglith when they come out. And so this now looks like the second Eucatastrophe, right? The Gondolindrim come out. And now the Western Front Army is way stronger than it was before.
Mm.
Right?
Yeah. Right. So I'm actually thinking, as I'm thinking about this, because it actually specifically says that he's guarding the paths of Sirion, right? Yeah. Which is where we having him popping up.
Yeah.
Anyway, so what if Hurin and his men do rush forward? They're still behind Fingon's army because A, they've got a greater distance to travel, and B, Gwyndor is a maniac, right? Yes. But Turgon holds the position for a time. They march up in good order. I mean, like, they probably do a... They do a... So they relieve Fingon as he's retreating, and they're able to form up now. And so instead of a retreat, they're able to kind of turn the battle for a little bit.
So the charge, Gwyndor's charge has happened.
Right.
Fingon looks like he's going to get cut off, like as they've charged in, mm-hmm. the armies of Morgoth threaten to surround them, and then the Gondolindrum come up and relieve them.
Right. Well, I think that Fingon is being thrown back.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Like Turgon stops it from turning into a rout.
Yeah. Yeah. Right. And that's when the meeting of Fingon and Hurin and Turgon on the field is glad, right?
Right. Yeah.
And then they form up there, and they're still like basically they can still be like, okay, now, but this wasn't the plan. But if Mithros, you know, hoofs it, he could still get up here in time for us to execute a version of the plan.
Right. And then and we so all they're have to holding. Hold.
Yeah.
They're holding thanks, when Mithros shows up. Right.
Yeah.
And so when Mithros shows up and they see him, they're still holding.
So we make it clear that if Turgon had not shown up, Morgoth's plan A would have worked. He would have shattered the whole Western Front army.
Right.
And then it would have been Mithros by himself.
Right. 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 And so, but then
being taken in a pincher movement, ironically. Right.
Right. And then when Mithros gets, when the Easterlings fall on Mithros, that's when the whole thing starts falling apart, because that's when Angband empties. So the young dragons and the werewolves and the trolls, Balrogs, the whole bit come flying out.
Fingon dies.
And at that point, the Western armies get routed. Right. And they make it back to the Fens of Sarek, which is when the men of Hithlum decide that, okay, we're going to stop here. We're going to stop them here. They're way out ahead of the Orcish armies. Right.
Yes.
And so we're going to hold here while Turgon retreats. But then orcs start popping up from the ground there,
mm-hmm.
Because of the handy tunnels that we have already set up. And that's when Huor gets killed and Hurin gets killed and captured. By the way, while I have been advocating for Hurin killing Baldog,
mm-hmm.
now that Handir is involved and needs a part to play and some sort of great destiny to have been laid upon him, I think that he can kill Baldog.
Hmm.
And I think that that will also be awesome, especially if he dies
while killing him.
Yeah. If he in fact also dies to save Hurin, who winds up unable to save Turin anyway. Despite all that,
He doesn't have to die though, because his father Haldir is supposed to be in this battle. Speaking of elderly, battle participants, so Baldog could kill Haldir, and Handir kills Baldog, which would mirror the confrontation between Baldog
and
Haldad back at the stockade.
Yes. That was my other thing about.
I want the father son attack on Baldog. For
I
that.
Like that.
That's cool. Yeah. I like that a lot.
Yeah.
I like that a lot. Okay. I do like that. By the way, I'm just I don't know why I forgot about the men of Dor Loman being the White Cavalry as they were from the beginning.
Mm-hmm.
But I love everything about this. Like, it really gives Hurin a marvelous role. Because, of course, when you're having to retreat from, you know, in the face of the enemy, it's your cavalry that makes that happen, right? It's the cavalry that enables your infantry not to get swamped by charging infantry when you're retreating, right? So Hurin is going to be, like, the men of Dor Loman will be covering the retreat all the way along. Like, from the beginning.
Yes.
That position will be established where Hurin is like, you know, he will say to Turgon, like, go, retreat right now, right? I'm going to charge so that you guys can retreat. And he charges, and they don't die yet, right? They successfully charge. And this is going to have to happen multiple times, right? Where he continues to charge and they continue to cover their retreat until, yeah, we get the unexpected thing at the Fens of Serek, right? And them coming in. And there's no escape. There's no way they're going to get... And then they do the final thing where they, like, dismount and say, no, we will hold them right here.
Right. Yes.
And so to make that... not just like a spontaneous act, but like it is that, you know, it is the Hurin's like whole like contribution to the battle, basically, is he's going to be.
Yeah.
Yeah. It flows. So the rear guard action of the men of Dor Loman is such a natural, like it just flows so organically out of that. Yeah. I just love it.
Yeah. And now, of course, the people of the Haladin, they're not mounted. So they're going to be hurting.
Yeah.
Throughout this whole process.
Yeah. Well, they'll be on foot with Fingon.
With Fingon.
The
yeah.
others. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I mean, Fingon gets killed by Balrog. So.
Yes.
Yeah.
That's not great.
Side question. Do we kill any Balrogs in this battle?
We don't need to.
I wasn't thinking that we should.
Okay. Just wanted to check. I mean,
we should kill some trolls for sure.
Yeah, yeah.
Sure.
But the having the first Balrog death be in Gondolin from, I mean, an elf deliberately killing it would be nice, that's, I think.
I
am looking forward to Ixellian versus Gothmog.
Me too. I just would want to make sure, I guess, how many are we killing?
In
more
Gondolin?
Than the two? Glorfindel and Ixellian?
I was just thinking the two in Gondolin, and then any more Balrogs that we have to kill, it happens in the War of Wrath.
Yeah. Okay. I was just wondering, because one of the things, if Gothmog, because that would mean that Gothmog would be the first Balrog to die.
Yeah.
Which is fine.
We can kill one other Balrog before him in Gondolin if we need to, but it'll be more shocking that they finally do actually kill a Balrog.
I think that
if he's the first one,
I think it will be better story wise. It'll have more impact if the first one is Gothmog.
Okay,
yeah.
I just was wondering if we wanted to, because I could see a scenario, for instance, in which if we did kill three. Like more, if we did kill more than two Balrogs in Gondolin, that it could get old hat by the time we get to Glorfindel, right?
Right. That's my problem is that if an unnamed Balrog or even a named Balrog who isn't Gothmog dies first, it's not as big a deal when Gothmog dies.
Well, it's even less of a Gothmog who's been like one of the captains from the start.
Yeah.
But I agree. I mean, the other thing though is to like lay the foundation of the fact that they're killable. But
yeah, so we kill Gothmog, we kill another one. That means we're down to seven now.
Mm-hmm.
And at least one needs to live to be Durin's Bane, and we were going to have another survive the War of Wrath just for funsies,
just
to have an extra unaccounted for Balrog in the world.
Yeah.
So that means we really only need to kill what?
Five others?
In the War of
the
Wrath.
War of Wrath, yeah.
Mm-hmm. So I think that's probably fine. We'll see.
Yes, once we have like Eonwe back on the field, we like, can have can multiple some Balrog deaths. Yeah, that's
he's game for some revenge for sure.
Yes,
they did kill him first.
They did kill him first. It's only fair. Yeah. Yes, an excellent
They're
going to
regret that for sure.
That's right.
Mistakes were made.
Yes. Okay.
If they struck him down and he became more powerful than they could possibly imagine.
Classic blunder. Classic blunder. Okay. All right. So I think that addresses most of my questions.
Mm.
I'm at the point now where I like the plan. The plan is flexible. Is appropriately adaptable. It works at all the different levels. It is. I also like the fact that it's not like some kind of like over ingenious stratagem, right? That's really complicated to execute. Like, it's not. This is not like I have a genius plan that no one's ever like no one's ever thought of in their lives before. Like, it's not that kind of a. It's not like a super devious bank heist plan, or you know that kind of thing. Yeah. You know, like it's not.
It's a regular. Solid battle
plan. Yes, exactly. Yes. Based on their knowledge of their enemy and of, you know, what they think he's capable of doing.
Warfare itself. And, yeah.
Yeah, exactly.
I feel like the clever, like all the little details and then the hidden guys come up from behind the rocks plans work on a much smaller scale.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
So
yeah.
I'm That's okay with a little bit of level. That. Right. I'm fine with a little bit of that working its way into the Glarung, Darthonian thing. But it would feel weird on a battle of this scale to have the and here's my hidden army that came up from
and the geography even though we're definitely our friend for that
with the giant flat plane in front of Angband like what are you doing but we do have the secret hidden army coming up we've got Gondolin like we are doing that trick
right
but it's just not on purpose.
Right. And that's the part is it was not part of anyone's plan.
Right. It wasn't part of the plan. And it's also not like they're a surprise. They're coming up out of nowhere, but they're not literally popping up. They're marching up like noise. Just no one was looking for them. Nobody expected to see them on either side. So, But yet they do come out and it is sort of beautiful how like if they had been involved in the planning from the beginning, that would have been exactly how they would have drawn it up, right? And that's kind of the beauty of it. Yeah. And we'll make it look like... And so that moment, which moment, of course, is the day is come, right? The night is passing moment, right? Is like, look, it's happening. It's happening. Everything is working out. Even now, this like new thing, right? Anyway, so I think that's good. And I know I missed a whole bunch of slides, but we talked about... I just want to looking... okay. Yeah, we... Mm. Oh, wait. Hang on. We overlooked a good question of yours, Marie. Beleg, Mablung, and Gil-galad.
Yeah, we're making the effort to put them in this battle. They don't die. They all make it out.
They're not going to fight with the Feanorians, we know.
No,
so,
no, they have to be on the Western Front.
They'll be. So we just put them with Fingon?
Mm.
That's fine, except Fingon dies. So how do they get out and he doesn't?
Mm.
Like,
well, I mean, like, they don't happen to be right next to him when it happens.
I get it.
It's a big.
I know, but what I meant is if we're gonna go to the trouble of putting them there, are they gonna accomplish anything in this battle?
Yes.
Are they interacting with any of the other characters on the field?
Yes.
Do we have anything in particular that we wanted for them?
Yes.
That we
one
need
of them's
to work
going
into our
to
plan?
Retrieve Narsil
from
the ground.
Okay.
Who's got it now?
So Hurin's allowed to have Narsil in the battle?
Yeah. We already talked about this. Morwen's going to give it to him to take in the battle, and then he's got to be separated from it in the battle so that it doesn't wind up captured along with it. I mean, although I guess that could still be arranged, but it doesn't wind up captured with him. And then I think that the easiest way to retrieve it is for Beleg or Mablung to get a hold of it. And to
take it to Doriath.
Right.
Be kind of fun if Gil-galad is the one I picked.
Or Gil-galad. when I saw Gil-galad on the slide, I immediately thought, that would be fun. Gil-galad gets a hold of it.
So funny you should mention all that, because one of the other suggestions was, wait. There's a way for Hurin to wear the dragon helm in battle. And that is that he wears it for this whole time And then when they make the decision to stop and get off the horses, he hands it to somebody who's retreating and surviving in the Beleg, Mablung, Gil-galad group. And be like, well, now I will face my enemies without my helmet, because who needs those?
Who needs helmets?
Have his, just look at helmets at that point.
Okay. The idea of him just giving up his helmet.
Me too.
I think that Turin, I like what we already said with the helmet.
I think that giving it to Turin is fine.
We're giving it to Turin.
But also, the thing to keep in mind, Turgon isn't the only one who escapes the battlefield, right? The problem is, so Fingon's whole army isn't like slaughtered
to a man. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. No.
They're going to scatter. The point is, the reason that Hurin and Huor end up defending the retreat of the Gondolindrim is for two reasons. Reason number one, they're the bigger force. Like, Fingon's army is scattered, right? So they're just running and scattering. They're not going to get, whereas the Gondolindrim are retreating in good order, they're the ones that are going to be pursued by the army. So so basically, and that means that Beleg and Mablung can go with the others and Gil-galad. Like, they can be, like, there can even be a moment where, you know, Turgon maybe is like, hey, I mean, I don't know. He's going to be like, I guess I'm High King now or whatever. But I mean, he can say to them, he can say to Gil-galad, and it's like, go, like, you know, go help, you know, help gather those that have fled and help them to escape.
And get them out.
Exactly. So somebody's got
to
help.
Don't let them go to Mithrim.
Yeah.
Because, which is good advice, because we know that Mithrim is going to be immediately taken after this.
Yeah. You're not going to be able to defend, you know, Aethel Sirion with the people you have. Anyway, just collect them up.
Right. And meanwhile, the people of Brethel are retreating, so it makes sense that Beleg and Mablung would be retreating with the men of Brethel. Yeah.
Exactly. Yeah. Now,
if Hurin gets unhorsed, by the way, that solves the lost weaponry problem, by the way. Just throwing that
possibly out. But in any case, reason number two, of course, why they're going to choose to defend the retreat of the Gondolindrim is that, unlike the other part of the army that's escaping, where the Gondolindrim are retreating to is meant to be a secret, right? They can accomplish something by keeping the enemy off of the Gondolindrim that they can't accomplish. But, you know, it's no secret where the others are running to, right? It's a secret where the Gondolindrim are going to. And the whole, like, obviously the impulse which is expressed most fully in Huor's prophetic declaration, right? But also which can pay off the oath that Hurin makes in episode one, right? I have sworn to keep the secret of where Gondolin is, and we will do that today. Like, we are going to keep the secret by keeping them off of you. Like, that's why we're going to be your rear guard.
Right, right.
And
Turgon is willing to take people with him, because that's how Rogren ends up in Gondolin. So he's part of Fingon's group, but
So some will end up with them, like Rogren, and we can show others as well. But the rest of Fingon's army is pretty much scattering. So yes, if the men of Brethil are also among those, the survivors of them are among those who are fleeing, then Beleg and Mablung and Gil-galad sticking with them and helping out over there makes a good deal of sense. So having them escape when other people don't escape and not go to Gondolin, there's more than one route off of the battlefield there in that place. And of course, on the other side, we know that the Fëanorians' escape is going to be enabled by Bor and Galadriel.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Mm-hmm. As they come in from the other side.
Right.
And the Beleg and Mablung could go through Dorthonion.
Yes.
Yeah.
Like, that's an option for
them. It's empty now. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. They could even potentially peel off. They could be with the Gondolindrim and peel off, up into Dorthonion at some point.
They could go the Rivel's route.
Exactly.
Uphill, but they could do it.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. But that's, of course, obviously not the way that Turgon is going to go. And again, that's because the main bulk of the army is still the Gondolindrum. It's only going to be a handful of folks that'll be going off that way. So,
yeah.
And of course, demonstrating that Beleg is totally comfortable finding paths through Dorthonion, not a bad thing. That'll be useful later. So,
right.
Beleg leading the troop of folks off up into soon to be Tower Nufuin is totally fine, right?
Okay. Okay.
And useful, even. Okay. All right, good. Okay, I'm looking at the Eastern Front notes. I think we're good. Uldor getting killed by Galadriel and the charge of Galadriel and Bor there. Were we going to give Mablung a replacement?
Well, I'm fine with him, like, killing a troll that just was going to kill one of his brothers or something. Yeah, like, he could do something heroic. I want to make sure we highlight him doing something heroic in this battle.
Yeah, we don't.
So that we don't completely rework that part. yeah, we're not like, oh, Galadriel took your role and you'd get to do nothing.
Nothing at all. Right, yeah.
Yeah.
And in some ways, actually, so I kind of, if it would be kind of fun and sort of fun in a tragic Feanorian way if he, like, saves the life of one of his more problematic brothers. Right. Mm. Yes. You know, and thus we can see that, like, you know, later on, it would have been better for, you know, whoever it is, Caranthi or Curufin, to have died that day or whatever.
Okay. Mm. Okay.
Well, yeah. Especially if it's Curufin, because he's kind of the, like, without him, resistance to Maivor's kind of falls apart.
You'd think. Right. And well, again, although, and I'm thinking here of particularly setting up the Doriath stuff.
Yes. Yeah.
Yeah. And presumably Curufin is the mastermind behind that.
Yeah.
I mean,
although obviously Kelegorm and Caranthi are pretty on board with it too.
Yeah. The third kinslaying, like, Mythos kind of has, like,
someone orchestrated that.
Yes.
We'll get there. Not gonna worry about that yet. We got lots of time. Right. And I don't just mean time to think about it. We need time for the story to do. We still literally have no idea what's going to go on in Doriath. So I want to wait till we tell that story to even try to figure out what's going to happen at the Havens because it'll depend on it.
Right. Maedhros is, in many ways, the best of the Feanorians. Yeah. But this season is his high point.
Yes.
His plans for this battle is he gets to be heroic. He gets to use all of his wisdom, wit, diplomatic, everything is being poured into the fight against Morgoth. He's uniting people to fight Morgoth. He's doing the right thing here.
Yeah.
There's a little bit of desperation to it, though, because he knows the consequences if he fails is he's going to have to turn all that on Doriath.
Yeah. And by the way, notice how the story that we've just been telling, both on the Dorthonian dragon plot and on the battlefield at Anfalgwith, are both Maedhros not quite committing suicide, but putting himself in extreme danger, right? Yeah. Basically saying, I'm either going to win or die.
Yeah.
Yes.
And that fits exactly what you're describing, right? Yeah. Those are the only two good outcomes from this situation.
He knows that if he loses...
And survives. Yes.
Things will go badly. And so by the time we get to the third kinslaying and the fourth kinslaying, Maedhros is no longer going to be a noble, heroic character.
Yeah.
I mean, that's not where he ends.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely.
We know that. So, and he doesn't feel like he's changed at all in between those times, but the audience is going to change their mind about
him. Exactly.
I don't know that he, because there comes a point where you realize that you've gone down the wrong path, but you feel like, I can't come back from that.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I can't make that stuff go away.
Yeah.
And so all that's really left for me is to keep going where I'm going.
Yes.
Because at least that gets me to something.
Mm-hmm.
And that's clearly what he does. He decides that it's more important to get the Silmarils back and fulfill that oath than literally anything else.
Yes.
Even when he's got Maglor saying, what if we just went back to Valinor and said, hey, Valar, we made a mistake about that whole oath thing. Right. Would you like to absolve us of this unbreakable oath and make us, like,
yes,
just call a do-over and just not do that?
Yeah.
And Mithras is like, no, we're going to fulfill the oath. So Magler puts it on the table of, we could maybe just not do the oath.
Right. Mm-hmm. No, exactly. But again, this is, that's why it fits so well. I wonder, mm-hmm, if Fingon might even call him on it at some point.
Yeah.
And say, I'm like, sure, why are you making yourself the bait every single time we get the, and you know, like, I don't know that we want to say it out loud, but I mean, just calling attention to the fact that the element of recklessness, the element of not just courage, but of coming close to throwing, mm-hmm, his life away, or like, again, yeah, putting himself in this position where, to the greatest extent of his ability, he is putting himself in a position where either victory or death are the only two probable outcomes.
Yeah.
Right.
But Fingon, that's what your dad did, remember?
Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
Was he wrong to do
was
that?
Was he wrong? Yeah. Like, I'm, and anyway, yeah. So I think it's, I love the way that that works out. That seems just to fit absolutely perfectly where Mithras is.
I also like the idea that Fingon's going to be concerned that Mithras might die in this battle.
Yes, exactly. Exactly.
Because obviously it's the reverse. Yeah.
No, that's it. That's it.
Yeah, we can definitely work with this.
Yep. Mm. Yep. Ah, so much good stuff. Okay. Fantastic. Well, that was good. That was really, I feel so much better about the battle. And I think we didn't really, one thing we didn't do here this evening is like map it out in the three episodes, like what's going to happen in which episode, but y'all will do a great job with that. I trust you guys to map that out over the course of the three episodes that we've broken it into, but
sure, no problem.
The plan seems solid. All right. So our next session will be on March 28th, Thursday, March 28th. 2 weeks from today, and we're going to be discussing the, we're going to be mapping out the frame.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. That's mapping good. Out the frame, so we can talk that through in more detail, and we can figure that out
so that we have 13 episodes of pieces of the frame instead of just some nebulous idea and attach it to the story.
Exactly. We'll work that through a little bit more, and meanwhile we're getting closer to script stuff. More script discussion is going to be happening on Friday the 22nd, right? Discussing episode 2. You guys are in motion.
Yes.
And we're working our way towards episode 1 is our Gondolin quasi bottle episode, right? So awesome.
Yep.
Awesome. Looking forward to that.
I'm pretty happy with it.
Frame next time, then, we continue to move forward. Thanks, everybody. Excellent work tonight. Thanks, everybody, for joining us. And I will say, as always, thanks for listening and Godspeed. Bye now.